Devil's Do, The Thomas Kane Series, Book Zero, written by Andrew Warren, narrated by Brian L. Anderson. Chapter 1. The tiny grill spat grease and smoke into the tropical air. Its blackened metal rods were covered by a thick, charred crust, the petrified remains of previous meals. But the smell emanating from the strips of meat cooking on its surface was mouth-watering. From the shore, Sarah leaned over the wooden railing of the narrow walkway and waved to get the attention of the tiny Thai woman working the grill. The grill was set up on a small boat, one of several that were docked in the muddy waters of a shallow canal that crossed through the Pattaya floating market. The market was a popular tourist attraction, and a bustling crowd of people shifted around her. As Sarah waited for the woman, she caught a glimpse of an older man wearing cargo shorts and a Hawaiian shirt that looked one size too small. He was eyeing her legs as she leaned over the railing. Her slim, lean body was tanned from weeks of travel, and she knew the tiny cutoffs and faded tank top she was wearing did little to conceal it. She was grateful she had kept her tan, despite the cloudy, gray skies that loomed over the marketplace. She had arrived in Thailand 2 weeks ago, and in that time the sun had barely peeked out from behind the thick, gloomy curtain. She ignored the lecherous man, and soon he disappeared into the crowd. She waved to the old woman again and finally caught her attention as she handed a styrofoam plate of food to another tourist. The woman's face was dark and lined with wrinkles. A green embroidered shawl was draped over her working clothes.
60 baht! 60 baht!
The old woman chanted. Sarah did some rapid currency conversions in her head. Two plates of food would cost her about 3 euros, which would just about buy her a can of soda back in Germany. She held up two fingers. The old woman nodded and prepared two plates for her. Each plate was stacked with rice, a cup of cucumber salad, and 3 skewers of sizzling meat. She handed the woman 6 20-baht notes and a 10-baht coin.
"Keep the change."
The old woman smiled and nodded and slid the plates over the railing to her. Sarah inhaled deeply. The meat smelled delicious, but she couldn't quite identify what it was.
"Chicken saute?"
she asked. The woman shook her head.
"Jerake, ka?"
Sarah had no idea what that meant, but she knew the proper response when ordering food in Thailand. She smiled and said,
"Aroy."
"Delicious." She grabbed the two plates and continued down the wooden walkway of the market. To her right, the long strip of water wound its way between the two sides of the market. The canal was crossed by several arched wooden bridges. Crowds of tourists made their way across each bridge, usually stopping in the middle to take pictures of boats in the water below. The canal was man-made, and the water was a dark, muddy brown. Its dull, flat surface only served to highlight the explosion of colorful fruits, seafood, silks, and other goods that filled every boat and stall in the market. Sarah took a deep breath as she absorbed the sights and sounds around her. She felt alive, the most alive she'd felt since finishing university. The idea of returning home, of finding a job in some law office in Hamburg, filing papers and reading court documents, seemed like just another cloud on a distant horizon. What kind of life was that, compared to what she had experienced in these months of travel? The warm, tropical climate, the thrill of new people, new places and, most of all, new possibilities. At that moment, she knew with absolute certainty this was the life she wanted. Her train of thought was suddenly interrupted as she felt a hand squeeze her ass through her torn, cut-off shorts. She shrieked and spun around, dropping one of the plates of food in the process. Remembering the leering old man in the Hawaiian shirt, she raised her hand and prepared to deliver a strong slap to whoever had groped her. She looked up and lifted her sunglasses off her face. She was staring into the warm brown eyes of Gunther, her university mate and traveling partner.
"After last night,"
she thought,
"Gunther is quite a bit more than just a mate."
"Arschloch!"
she screamed in German, beating his tan chest with her tiny fists.
"You scared me!"
Gunther was shirtless, and his skin also held a golden tan. A black tribal tattoo snaked around the lean, athletic muscle of his right arm, and a shell necklace hung from his neck. Sarah watched the muscles move beneath his skin as he threw back his head and laughed. She found herself thinking more about the previous night. That feeling of being alive, of infinite possibilities on the horizon. Gunther was part of those possibilities now, too. She couldn't deny she was hungry for a repeat performance of their intimate physical gymnastics. Liebling, if you haven't relaxed by now, what am I going to do with you when we go someplace really crazy? He asked. She let her fingers linger on his chest.
I know. Sorry, this pervert was stalking me before. Just got me on edge, I guess.
Gunther looked deep into her blue eyes and brushed a wisp of blonde hair from her face. Well, who could blame him, eh? I was getting an eyeful of you myself. You know I love those little shorts. She laughed.
But look what you made me do.
She pointed to the spilled food on the ground.
That's your lunch down there. Enjoy.
She scooped some rice into her mouth with chopsticks. Gunther reached for her plate, but she turned her back on him.
Oh, no. Clean up your mess first.
Gunther grabbed the plastic plate off the ground and used it to scrape the fallen mess of food off the walkway and into the canal. A school of tiny black fish started to the surface and nibbled at the morsels as they sank into the water. He tossed the plate in a garbage can, and the two walked through the market. Gunther threw his arm around her shoulders and grabbed a piece of meat off her plate. He popped it in his mouth and chewed. "It's good," he said. His words slurred as he continued to grind the meat between his teeth. "What is it?" Sarah shrugged.
"Chicken saute, I think. I got it from one of the boats. The woman who served me called it jerrycake."
Gunther swallowed and scanned the market stalls. "Jerrycake, huh? I think I need a beer."
"A beer now? Why?"
"Because jerrycake means crocodile. And in Thailand, one does not eat crocodile without a cold Singha beer." Sarah laughed.
"Oh, that's a rule, yeah?"
"It is now. Gunther's rule on eating crocodile in Thailand with a beautiful girl." Sarah leaned into him and kissed his cheek.
"I like this rule. Let's go."
They shared the plate of food as they walked arm in arm through the market. Gunther spotted a small stall that was selling beer from a cooler, and he broke off. "Be right back. Don't eat all the crocodile without me." Sarah watched him waiting in line at the food stall. His legs were lean and strong, the result of months spent surfing and hiking around the world. She looked up at the cloudy sky and decided that, once they left the market, they would be spending the rest of the day in their bungalow by the beach. They could go sightseeing again tomorrow. After all, there were infinite possibilities on the horizon. What would it hurt to spend one more day in bed, satisfying their passions? She heard the high-pitched sound of a child crying. Spinning around, she saw a little Thai girl, no more than 5 or 6 years old, stumbling through the crowd. Her simple tan dress with blue and pink stripes looked handcrafted.
"Maybe her mother is working on one of the boats, and she wandered off,"
Sarah thought. No one was stopping to help. The crowd simply pushed past. Oblivious to the crying child, Sarah tossed the remaining food in a garbage can and walked over to the girl. Kneeling down in front of the child, she put a reassuring hand on her shoulder.
"Hey, it's okay. Are you all right?"
The girl looked at her with small, deep brown eyes. Her mouth seemed to be struggling to form words. Sarah pulled a napkin from her pocket and brushed the tears from the girl's puffy cheeks.
"There you go. Are you lost?"
Sarah saw a flash of movement over the girl's shoulder. She looked up and saw the old man, the one who had been leering at her earlier, moving across the bridge towards them. Sarah knew that, in addition to the beauty and energy that she thrived on, Pattaya had a dark side. Prostitution and sex tourism were common. If one was seeking perversions, anything imaginable could be found in the city's dark alleys and seedy bordellos, for a price. Of course. Was that why the girl was crying? Was this pervert in a Hawaiian shirt chasing her? She took the little girl's hand and stood up.
"Come on,"
she said.
"I know someone who can help."
The girl continued crying but dutifully followed along, her little legs moving as fast as she could to keep up with Sarah. The two made their way back to the food stall. Gunther smiled as he walked towards them, taking a long swig of beer from a frosted Singha bottle. "Who's this, then?" He smiled at the girl and for the first time, she stopped crying. Sarah melted, knowing how reassuring she found that smile herself.
I found her crying over there.
She pointed towards the bridge. The man in the Hawaiian shirt was still there, rummaging through a box of seashells perched on a rickety souvenir cart.
That's the guy I told you about, the one who was stalking me. I think he was following her.
Sarah said in a hushed whisper. Gunther looked down and spoke to the girl in broken Thai. May, you lost your mother? The child stared at him in silence. Gunther spoke a few more words to her, but it was clear she could not understand him.
What do we do?
Sarah asked.
We can't just leave her here.
Excuse me, I help you?
A sing-song male voice asked. Sarah and Gunther turned to see an older Thai man standing next to them. He was tall for a local and looked to be in his 40s. His navy blue polo shirt and khaki shorts looked crisp and brand new, and his body was lean and athletic. He was carrying a large canvas duffel bag that was slung over his shoulder on a leather strap. Above his dark brown eyes, his brow was furrowed in concern.
Her little one crying. She lost?
Sarah looked the man up and down. She turned to look at the Westerner in the Hawaiian shirt, but he was nowhere to be seen.
Yeah, man. We think some pervert dude was stalking her, Gunther said. She looks scared.
The older man kneeled in front of the little girl and spoke to her in Thai. Sarah couldn't understand what he was saying, but the tone of his words sounded reassuring. The little girl stared at him with wide eyes and nodded. She continued to grasp Sarah's hand. The man reached into the pocket of his shorts and pulled out a small plastic bag of dried fruit. He opened the bag and held it out to the girl. She gingerly reached in, grabbed one of the fruits, and stuffed it in her mouth. The man looked up at Sarah.
Dried plums. They my favorite when I was her age. Taste like candy.
He grunted, stood up, and dusted off his knees.
She too scared to speak, but she must be lost. There's a police box at the end of the market. I take her there. They find parents.
He reached his hand towards the girl and spoke to her again in Thai.
Ma Cobb Chan? Come, come, little one.
The girl looked up at Sarah. She looked back at the man, shook her head, and shuffled behind Sarah's legs.
Look, she's scared. She doesn't want to go,
Sarah said.
Let's just call the police, and they can meet us here.
Gunther gave Sarah a condescending look.
Babe, come on. You want to wait here all day for the police?
Sarah stared daggers at Gunther, then turned to the older man.
No offense, sir, but we don't know who you are, and she doesn't seem to want to go with you.
Sarah saw a ripple of anger cross the man's features. He seemed about to speak, but then hesitated. He nodded.
Yes, yes, of course, you're right. Sorry, just want to help the child. Tell you what, I go to police, bring them back here.
He lowered his duffel bag to the ground.
You wait here with child. Watch my bag, okay? Very heavy. I be right back.
The man wandered off down the market. Within a few seconds, he was lost in the shifting crowd of tourists and vendors hawking their wares. Gunther pursed his lips and uttered a low whistle.
Okay, that was a little odd.
Sarah shook her head.
I don't know. I don't see the Hawaiian shirt guy anymore. And something about that other guy was weird.
Gunther laughed.
Jeez, babe, don't be so paranoid. You don't trust anybody.
She looked down at the child, who returned her gaze with wide eyes. She lowered her voice.
Okay, then why did he leave his bag? They say you're never supposed to take a stranger's bag. What if it's full of drugs?
Gunther hefted the bag off the ground.
Well, if it is, we hit the jackpot because this thing weighs a ton.
That's not funny.
Come on, let's check it out.
Gunther pushed through the crowd and walked to the side of the market, where the constant stream of people thinned to a low trickle. Sarah and the child followed, hand in hand.
Gunther, I don't like this. Do you know what the sentence here is for drugs?
Gunther turned his back to the crowd.
Keep your voice down, he hissed.
He zipped open the bag. The little girl began to cry again, and her face turned bright red. Sarah pressed up against Gunther to peer over his shoulder.
Well, what is it?
Just a second. Can you quiet her down?
Gunther rummaged through the bag, pulling out a bundle of cheap t-shirts.
It's just stupid t-shirts. Tourist stuff. Oh, fuck.
Kneeling, he gingerly set the bag on the ground. Sarah caught a glimpse of electrical wires and two large, clear cylinders taped together. Each cylinder was filled with a yellowish, crumbled powder. A red LED light attached to one of the wires was flashing.
What the hell is...
she began, but Gunther grabbed her arm. Sarah, shut up and run! Sarah scooped up the screaming girl and ran. She'd gone only a few steps when suddenly everything she could see, hear, or feel was blotted out in a giant ball of orange fire. She screamed, but the sound was silenced by the explosion. She felt her body move and had just enough time to realize she was not running. She was flying through the air. Her skin was burning, but she felt no pain. Her eardrums and eyeballs ruptured from the shockwave, and blood cells in her lungs exploded as her body was torn apart. As the pinpoint of white light that was her consciousness dimmed out, a dying thought flickered through her mind. This was true infinity, infinite blackness, infinite darkness, infinite possibilities reduced to an infinity of cold, black space. Chapter 2. A light but steady rain washed the grime and residue from the roofs of the go-go clubs and beer bars that lined either side of Soy 6, part of Pattaya's infamous red light district. It was early October, near the end of the rainy season for Thailand. Normally, the afternoon sun would have already heated the air to a stifling 90 degrees or more. Instead, the unending drizzle of rain cooled both the climate and the wallets of the visiting tourists. Today, once again, the rain had kept the crowds away. Only a few diehards, old men with beer guts stretching the seams of their cheap, local t-shirts, ventured out into the downpour. They meandered through rivers of filthy water that rushed down either side of the street, occasionally stopping to haggle with bored-looking bar girls. Despite the lack of customers, the girls looked like they would rather go back to painting their nails. The atmosphere in Ruby's Club, a beer bar towards the end of the street, mirrored the gloomy weather outside. Music blasted from the bar speakers, but it seemed unable to drown out the sound of the falling rain. A beautiful bar girl dressed in a sexy school uniform danced on the center stage, spinning around a gleaming chrome pole. But the motley assortment of locals and regular customers paid her no attention. The few customers in the place sipped lukewarm glasses of beer from the front patio bar and watched the rain falling into the street with quiet, detached reflection. The sole exception was a lone man standing towards the center of the patio bar. He was of average height, but his arms and back rippled with muscle beneath his slim-fitting, black linen shirt. Everything about him seemed hard and angular. His hair was buzzed military short and worn in a Caesar cut. His nose was slim and hawk-like. His eyebrows were two dark slashes, cutting across his forehead. The only soft thing about his face were his eyes. They were large and almond-shaped. Delicate black lashes blinked, revealing bright, baby-blue irises. His left eye had a lazy tick, and seemed to dart and roll towards the edge of his face. He slammed his empty glass down on the counter. The noise echoed through the bar like a gunshot. A few of the regulars looked up in annoyance, but they glanced away after meeting the man's gaze. There was something unnerving about those strange, beautiful eyes set in such a hard face.
Busha, more vodka, and no more this cheap sot. I want top shelf. Beluga bitch.
The bartender was a stocky, pretty girl whose dark skin and silky black hair were typical of girls from the northwestern Izon region. She hurried over and set another glass down on the counter.
No beluga, sir,
she said with her brightest forced smile.
Stoli okay? Good Russian vodka.
Bah, Stoli is also sot. All you have is piss here.
The bartender's smile flickered.
Stoli okay, sir?
She repeated. The man nodded and looked away as she poured his drink. He turned to another man, who was sipping beer from a tall, frosted glass a couple chairs down at the bar. He was wearing a white t-shirt, olive-green pants, and battered suede desert boots. He was taller and lankier than the Russian, and his body had the lean, taut look of a natural athlete.
What is it with this bar, eh?
The Russian grunted.
They call this vodka? Svidis sot. Finnish sot. Even Russian sat. All peace, I say.
The man down the bar gave no response. He did not look up from his beer. A tall, lighter-skinned bar girl with thick, wavy brown hair sat down on the stool next to the Russian. She wore black hot pants, a black bustier top, and scarlet high heels. She leaned towards the Russian and spoke into his ear, arching her back and making sure to give him a good view of her cleavage in the process.
Hey, mister, you have nice eyes. Buy me drink?
She was stunningly beautiful, and her sudden appearance seemed to improve the Russian's mood. His wide, blue eyes drank her in, and she leaned back as his unnerving stare transversed her body.
Sure, baby, I buy you a drink. What's your name?
I'm Nayana. What your name, mister?
I am Alexei. Alexei Rudov. Delighted to meet you.
He took her hand in his. She let him caress it for a moment, then tried to pull it back. He gripped it tight in his fist. The muscle in his arms bulged. She giggled and tried to play it off.
You strong, baby. Big, strong man.
The bartender set down a drink in front of the girl, without asking. It was a lady drink, a tiny bit of alcohol mixed with fruit juice and club soda. Despite its low alcohol content, it cost 150 baht, about twice the cost of a normal drink. The Russian, Alexei, nodded his approval, and the bartender drifted away again.
You have pretty hands,
he said, his large, meaty paws engulfing her tiny fingers. She laughed as she sipped her drink with her free hand.
You like?
She asked.
Come upstairs with me. I treat you good. 2,000 baht.
Alexei Rudov twisted his lips into a smile. He threw back his head and laughed.
Da, da, I fucking love Thailand. Drink up, my lovely. I take you back to my hotel room. Long time, 4,000 baht. I want to take my time with a piece of ass this fine.
The girl sipped her drink and smiled, but her brow furrowed in concern. Maybe it was the way he gripped her hand, or the unnerving stare, and that lazy, floating eye. Something about the man led her to shake her head.
No, baby. I only do short time. 2,000 baht. We go upstairs, right now. I make you feel so good.
Short time was bar girl slang for a quickie. A brief shower upstairs. Then sex in a somewhat private room that contained little more than a bed, a nightstand, and a box of condoms. Once the client finished, they would go back downstairs, and that was that. Long time would mean an all-night affair, usually at the client's hotel room. Alexei jerked up on her arm, and she gasped as he pulled her to a standing position. Her glass tipped and rolled off the bar. It shattered on the ground, and its sweet, sticky content spilled across the counter.
I'm not spending $1,000 a night on a suite at the Hilton so I can fuck in some flea-infested shithole. You'll come with me. I want to enjoy my time with you.
The girl struggled to free her hand from his grasp. She no longer bothered faking a smile, and her eyes were wide with fear.
No, baby. Short time, okay? I only do short time.
Alexei raised his free hand back, and the other patrons in the bar looked away. There was no mistaking the gesture. Everyone knew that, whatever happened next, it would be safer not to get involved in yet another drunken brawl over a bar girl. Alexei swung his arm forward in an open-handed slap, but jerked to a stop midway. Someone was holding his arm in a firm grip. It was the man from the end of the bar. A few patrons fished crumpled banknotes from their pockets and meandered away into the rain. A couple slid inside the dark interior of the bar to enjoy the striptease show. Alexei found himself staring into the man's unblinking eyes. They were emerald green, and as cold and hard as the gemstones they resembled. His face had the tan skin and dark stubble of a local, an expat who could no longer bother to shave or slather on sunscreen on a daily basis. There was a slight hollowness to his features, a haunted shadow that hung over his face, beneath his short, swept-back brown hair.
You heard the lady. Short time only, the man said.
His voice was low, but it cut through the noise of the rain like a steel blade. There are hundreds of other girls working the streets, and in weather like this, I'm sure you can have your pick. Alexei stared at the man for a second. Take your hand off me, he said, enunciating each word. The man removed his hand. Alexei squinted at him. Who the hell are you? Have we met? The man looked Alexei in the eye and shook his head. No, you don't know me. Alexei glared at the man and looked him up and down. The man was known by many names throughout town. Few knew his true identity. In Pattaya, most knew him as Mark Waters, a shady Farang expat with a questionable source of income and an intimidating stare that tended to silence unwanted questions. His real name was Thomas Kane. Let's drink, Kane said. This day is shitty enough as it is. He gestured to the bartender, and she hurriedly prepared two vodkas on ice. Alexei let go of Nayana. She took a few steps back, but did not leave the bar. Something about you looks familiar to me, Alexei said. Kane shook his head. I said you don't know me. I don't know who you are either, and I don't really care. Do you want a drink or not?
Come on, baby.
Nayana pleaded with Alexei.
Let's go upstairs. We have good time. I lots of fun. You see.
He ignored her. A shadow crossed the bar. Kane looked up and saw a second man step up behind the Russian. He was taller, and his arms and shoulders bulged with thick ropes of muscles beneath a skin-tight black t-shirt. Kane sighed. Who I am is not important, I guess, Alexei said. But please, meet Gregor. Gregor is happy to make your acquaintance. And you will see, he is very important man. The bartender slid the two drinks over to Kane and Alexei. Alexei ignored his. Kane picked up his and took a long sip. Funny, he doesn't look it. Alexei laughed. Gregor took a step forward. Well, my friend, when the police fish you out of the gutter with a face full of broken teeth, maybe you will change your mind. Alexei threw some bills on the counter. But please, first enjoy your drink. It's on me. He stormed out of the bar, leaving Gregor behind. The big man cracked his knuckles and stepped towards Kane. Chapter 3. As Gregor moved into strike, Kane held the base of his glass in his right hand and swung it against the bar. The glass shattered, leaving a pair of jagged, glittering shards attached to the base. Gregor was huge, but he moved like a diesel truck. Kane watched the muscles in his assailant's shoulders compress as the man wound back for a punch. Like a tree felled by a lumberjack, Gregor's massive right arm swung through the air in a powerful blow, but he had telegraphed the direction of the attack. Using a small, lightning-fast movement, Kane slid left and stepped inward, closing the gap. The punch sailed past the right side of his head, just missing his face. He kept his right arm up tight against his face as a guard. As Gregor's momentum carried him forward, Kane struck with his left fist, landing two quick rabbit punches to the man's right side. With any luck, he thought, I'll bruise this bastard's liver and end the fight quickly. The big man struggled to regain his balance. Kane pivoted and lashed out with the broken glass. The weapon sliced across Gregor's forehead. Nayana, still watching from the sidelines, screamed as a curtain of red blood spilled down the big man's face. Gregor roared in fury. He charged forward, lashing out wildly with his powerful arms, but the blood in his eyes blinded him. Kane ducked under the wild swings. He waited, waited. At last, Gregor paused, panting from exertion. Kane saw his opening and struck. He punched straight out with his left hand. The jab struck Gregor's chin. Kane winced as he felt the crushing blow against his knuckles, but he didn't slow his assault. He leapt forward, following the punch with a swift right elbow strike. Gregor stumbled backwards. He reached up, wiping the blood from his face. His eyes were clear now, and they gleamed at Kane with a hateful stare. Kane threw a right hook, but this time Gregor was ready for him. He blocked the punch with an outside left hand and hooked it around Kane's arm in the process. As Kane struggled to free his arm, the big man sliced in with his elbow, knocking Kane's face left, then right. The power of the two blows was immense. Kane stumbled back as Gregor let go of his arm. The force of the second elbow strike had spun him around. He fought to clear the haze in his mind as he felt two strong arms wrap around his chest. The grip tightened, and he was heaved into the air. He gasped and coughed as his breath was driven from his lungs. The grip tightened even more, and a red haze fell over his vision. He kicked his feet backwards, but they dangled uselessly in the air. He couldn't make contact with Gregor's knees or shins, and even if he could, he doubted he could strike with enough force to make the beast of a man release his hold. Gregor grunted again and ratcheted his arms tighter together. Kane felt the pressure compress his ribs and knew they would crack if the man heaved him up into the air again. He reached out with his arms, struggling to grab something, anything he could use as a weapon against Gregor. His flailing hand felt cold glass and liquid. Alexei's drink. The man had refused to touch it before he slinked away. Kane grabbed the glass and swung it over his shoulder, striking Gregor's wounded face. Gregor roared in pain. The vodka washed across the bloody gash in his forehead, sending a spasm of stinging pain through the huge man's face. He did not release his grip, but his arms involuntarily flexed as the pain ran through his body. Kane slid down a few inches, and he felt his feet touch the floor. He swung his head backwards, and the top of his skull smashed into Gregor's nose. The man uttered something between a groan and a sneeze, and dropped Kane. As Kane hit the ground, Gregor stumbled backwards a few steps, cradling his broken nose. Rivulets of blood streamed between his fingers. Kane sucked a lungful of breath and spun around, wasting no time in pressing the attack. With Gregor's hands occupied, Kane leapt to his feet and swung his left leg forward in a savage kick to the man's solar plexus. Gregor bent forward, grunting as the kick knocked the wind out of him. Standing over Gregor, Kane grabbed a beer bottle off the bar counter. He swung it straight down, smashing it straight onto Gregor's skull. The glass exploded, lacerating his fingers and burying tiny sparkling fragments into Gregor's head. Gregor collapsed to the ground like a rag doll. A low groan escaped his lips, and then he was silent, unmoving. Kane stood where he was, panting. "I've gotten sloppy," he thought. "Stupid." There was no reason for the fight to have gone on as long as it had. No reason for it to have started in the first place. He could have handled it a million different ways. Why had he chosen violence? No, he thought. Don't lie to yourself. This is who you are. This is why you can't go home. This is why you had to leave her. Rebecca.
He did?
Nyana asked in a quiet voice, interrupting Kane's thoughts. He looked at Gregor's body and shook his head. I don't know. But if he's not, he's going to be pissing blood when he wakes up. A stream of Thai profanity erupted from the beautiful girl's mouth. Kane couldn't understand most of it, but obviously she was upset. Hey, Nyana, just calm down. It will be. He held up his hands and noticed the blood streaming from the gashes left by the shattered glass. Sirens howled in the distance. Their mournful wailing grew close. Kane knew what that meant. The royal police were on their way. He had bribed the police in the past, payoffs to look the other way when he smuggled shipments of counterfeit handbags or stolen iPhones. But a body, a violent altercation, blood. He couldn't take the chance that they might arrest him, even temporarily, and run his prince.
Come, come, follow me,
Nyana said.
We go out the back.
Kane followed her into the bar. She grabbed a clean towel from the kitchen as she herded him towards the rear service door.
Here, wrap your hand.
Kane nodded and wound the white cloth around the gash in his hand. The towel was quickly stained a mottled shade of pink as his blood soaked through the rag.
What's wrong with you? You crazy?
Nyana muttered. Something was off about that guy, Kane said. You saw it yourself. That's why you wouldn't go back to his hotel room. The beautiful girl nodded as they turned the corner on a small corridor that led behind the kitchen.
He bad man, I think, but I talk him into short time. We bang, he leave. Now instead, big mess. And where I find another guy in this weather? I got kid to feed, you know?
I know, Nyana. I'm sorry. I was just worried for you. Nyana opened the rear door, and the thick, hot air from outside exploded into the corridor. Kane squinted out into the alley and ran behind the bar. It was devoid of life as the flooded streets out front. Nyana put her hand on his face, and her expression softened.
You are a good man, I know.
Kane shook his head. No, Nyana, I'm not a good man.
You good to me. You look out for me, other girls too. But sometimes, when I look in your eyes...
She hesitated.
Sometimes, I see something inside you, looking back at me. Something scary.
The sirens outside grew louder. The beautiful girl leaned in close, and her skin smelled of baby oil and jasmine. She kissed his cheek.
You go now. Take care of Hand. Stay low for a while. I come see you later, okay?
Kane nodded. Right. He headed out into the rain.
Hey!
Nyana called after him. He turned and saw her leaning in the doorway. Her smile was radiant, and for a second, he felt as if the sun had managed to pierce the clouds above with its dazzling rays.
Thank you,
she said.
You're a good friend to me.
He waved and started away, quickening his pace. Within a few minutes, the bar, the blood, and the body of the big Russian man were all left in the gloom behind him. Chapter 4. Kane stared out the window of his small, sparse apartment. The place was clean, to the point of being sterile. No art hung on the walls. No pictures of family or loved ones sat on his desk. He never knew if he would have to leave in a hurry, so he kept his furniture and belongings to a minimum. The place felt empty. The building was far enough away from the walking street that the noise of the crowds was usually a distant murmur. But tonight, the only sound he heard was the rain pelting the windows and the muddy streets below. He watched the sheets of rain run down the cracked pane of glass. The streetlights reflected a halo of red and green circles in the droplets on the window. He thought about what had happened earlier in the day. The fight. The blood. Nyana had said he was a good friend. Kane wasn't sure that was true. He looked back over his past, the things he had done, the lives he had taken. All in the interest of preserving democracy. He suppressed a grim laugh. The interests he had been preserving were those of his handler, a high-level case officer in the CIA. Him, and other men like him. They claimed they were acting for the greater good, and Kane had believed them. Over the years, he had seen the cost of their vision of the future claimed in blood, a cost they relied on others to pay. Kane had begun to wonder if the price was too high. It had been Rebecca, a woman he had worked with briefly in the CIA, who had awoken something in him, the ability to feel again, the desire to see more in himself, to be more than just a weapon, a blunt instrument sent out to murder. Their affair was brief, but in their time together she had touched him, changed him. But it was that love, that desire to change, that had forced him to remove her from his life. Kane was betrayed. To cover up an unsanctioned black op, his handler arranged to have Kane and his partner disappear. Kane saw his partner murdered in cold blood, gunned down by the targets they were sent to eliminate. Kane managed to survive the attack, but suffered through a period of brutal captivity and torture. And when he finally escaped and returned home, he discovered the ultimate betrayal. His country believed that he was the traitor responsible for his partner's murder. He knew that any further contact with Rebecca would only put her in danger. He had brought death to her doorstep. The only way to keep her safe was to allow others to believe him dead. So, he disappeared. Kane knew how to survive off the grid. He used his contacts and criminal connections to make a meager living on the outskirts of society. He had been trained to operate invisibly, leaving as little sign of his presence as possible. It wasn't a fulfilling life, but it kept him and those he cared about safe. Deep down, he feared that all the bloodshed, all the pain and suffering he had caused, was a curse. He could never escape it, no matter how far he ran. Violence and death were always just a few steps behind him. Now, violence had followed him to Nyana. There was a knock on the door. Kane paced across the studio apartment. He peeled back a small piece of tape that covered the peephole in the door. The tape was a security precaution. It kept people outside from being able to look through and track his movements, watching for him to block the light. Looking through the tiny fisheye lens, he saw Nyana standing in the dark hallway. She cradled a bag of groceries in her arms. He opened the door. Nyana, You know you don't have to. The beautiful girl rolled her eyes.
Kane Vakae, just let me in.
Kane smiled as she pushed past him and entered the apartment. Cops give you a hard time? He asked as he shut the door behind her. Did the Russians come back?
Cops come, ask questions. I flirt, they leave, just like always. And you know how many Russians we get in bar? They all the same. Think their money make them kings. I can handle them.
She set the groceries down on the counter and surveyed the room.
You've been living here how long? Place always look empty. You need a plant.
Kane laughed. Trust me, plants aren't my specialty. Nyana gave him a hug, and Kane winced as her arms brushed against his ribs. She looked him over with concern and wrinkled her nose.
Still sore, huh? You smell like ooh. You take hot shower. I cook.
Kane didn't speak that much Thai, but he knew the word ooh. It meant excrement. He locked the door, replaced the tape, and trudged towards the bathroom.
You hungry tonight?
Nyana called from the kitchen. Starving! Kane shouted back as he stripped off his sweaty shirt and turned on the shower.
Good. I cook lots. Keep you healthy for next time you fight.
Kane stuck his head out the door as he waited for the shower to warm up. What makes you think there's a next time? He heard pots and pans clattering in the kitchen. Nyana leaned out and smiled at him.
Men like you, always they fight.
Kane shook his head, closed the bathroom door, and stepped under the scalding hot water. A few minutes later, he was showered and seated at a tiny folding table they set up near the kitchen. Nyana had cooked a simple green curry, and the smell of cumin, ginger, and chicken wafted through the apartment. Somehow, the smells of Nyana's cooking transformed the small, Spartan space into something else. To Kane, for the couple of hours she was there, the empty apartment became a home. Kane lifted his chopsticks to his mouth and devoured another bite of the spicy dish. He washed it down with a sip of cold beer from a frosted glass. How's your brother doing? He asked. Nyana made a clicking sound with her tongue.
Oh, Tavi? So much trouble, that one. He get into fight today, too. Black eye.
A look of concern flashed across Kane's face, but Nyana smiled and shook her head.
Don't worry, nothing serious. Just boys being boys.
Kane looked up at her as he shoveled more food in his mouth. If you say so. Just make sure he keeps away from the street gangs. Nyana took a sip of beer and pushed at the food on her plate with her chopsticks.
He crazy, but not stupid. I tell him you won't be there to save him next time.
I didn't save him, Kane said. I just talked to some people. Made them see it was in their best interest to leave him alone. Kane smiled, but a dark glint flashed in his green eyes. Nyana smacked his hand.
Don't be so modest. You save his life. I owe you.
Tavi was Nyana's younger brother, a street thief who sold tourists cheap trinkets and sometimes lifted their wallets in the process. He had run into trouble with the organized crime gangs that ran the area. Kane had used his connections and a few well-placed threats to straighten things out. After that, Nyana has shown up at his door, offering to reward him the only way she knew how. He turned her down. He was lonely, and she was beautiful, but it just didn't feel right. The next day, she showed up with a basket of fresh chicken and vegetables from the market. Again, he tried to turn her away, but without saying a word, she brushed past him into his tiny, dismal apartment. She found her way to the kitchen and cooked him dinner. She had repeated this simple act of kindness once a week, every week since. Now, he looked forward to Nyana's home-cooked meals and their conversation afterwards. Somehow, she had become his closest friend, despite the fact that she knew nothing about him or his past. When Kane's plate was clean, Nyana poured him another beer and cleaned the table. She turned from the sink and watched as Kane sat down on the small bed, wincing in pain. Nyana walked over and sat next to him, her face filled with concern.
Hey, you hurt bad, huh?
I'm fine, Kane said. Just need some rest. Nyana shook her head.
Let me see. Shirt off now.
Nyana, I...
No buts,
she snapped.
Shirt off. Lay down. Now.
Kane sighed, but he did as she said. Nyana whistled as her eyes danced over Kane's toned, muscular abdomen. The skin above his ribs was mottled with ugly purple bruises.
Big strong man, huh? The other guy bigger, though. He mess you up. Wait here.
Nyana got up and rummaged through her purse. She grabbed a tube of ointment and sat back down, straddling Kane's body. Kane shifted, trying to push her off. Nyana, come on. The beautiful girl laughed and pointed her finger at him.
Hey, don't get any funny ideas. Serious business here.
She began to rub the ointment on his bruises. Kane gritted his teeth as her fingers pressed into the sore, tender flesh.
My mother used this ointment on my father after tree fell on him,
Nyana said.
Now I use it when I dance. Good stuff. It help.
Thank you. I appreciate it. She shook her head.
I keep telling you, it nothing. You help me, I help you.
Nyana's fingers traced the small white scar that sat just above his chest, near his shoulder.
What happened here?
Kane sat up, and Nyana shifted her weight off of him. She sat next to him on the bed. That happened a long time ago, in Japan. Nyana picked up her beer from the floor and took a sip.
Another fight?
Kane ran his fingers through his hair. Not exactly. I tried to help someone. Things got complicated.
But did you help them?
Yeah, I did.
You saved their life too, I bet. I told you. You good man. You do good things.
Kane exhaled. Listen, it's getting late, and I'm exhausted. You should go. Make sure your brother gets home safe. Nyana met his gaze. Her deep brown eyes were warm and seemed to smile with a life of their own.
Why do you fight for me?
She asked in a soft voice.
Other guys, they want this or they want that. You don't want anything. You help me. Look out for me. Look out for my brother. All I do is cook you dinner.
Kane stood up and put on his shirt. Today, you said you saw something in me. Something scary. Nyana nodded.
Sometimes, but that not all I see.
Kane sighed. At night, I have dreams. Nightmares. Terrible things. Things I've done. Kane touched the scar on his shoulder. That person I told you about, the one I helped? Nyana nodded. Used to be. That memory was enough to keep the nightmares away. Not anymore. But when you come here, somehow I feel at peace.
No nightmares,
Nyana said. Kane nodded. You're a good friend to me too, Nyana.
I'm glad,
she said as she stood up and slung her purse over her shoulder. She kissed Kane on the cheek.
Remember, good and bad in all of us. Yin and yang. People look at me, they see bad things too. But I see more. You need to see more in you.
Kane called her a cab, and she left his apartment, smiling at him one last time as he shut the door behind her. That night, the sound of the rain and the throbbing pain in his muscles kept him awake for several hours. But when he finally drifted to sleep, he was at peace. He did not dream. He slept like the dead. Chapter 5. The rain continued to drench Pattaya the following day. That afternoon, Kane met with a contact at a beer bar just off the walking street to discuss a possible business opportunity. His contact was a small, unassuming man who wore round glasses and a white linen suit. His name was Eugene Lee, and he owned a factory in Taiwan that was churning out replica Rolex watches. With a flourish of his hand, Lee set a sample of his wares on the bar counter. He beamed with pride. Real one made in Switzerland. Cost many, many baht. This one uses Japanese movement. Only 100 baht. Kane sipped his drink and looked around to make sure they were unobserved. The place was dead, as the rain continued to drive away customers. He hefted the watch in his hands. The workmanship looked good. The second hand moved in a smooth, continuous sweep, rather than the choppy, ticky motion of the cheaper counterfeits. He set the sample back down on the bar. Save the sales pitch. My job is to get them into the country. Selling them is your problem. Kane threw some cash down on the counter. That's for the drinks. Let me know when you have enough merchandise to move. Oh, and some free advice. There's only one X in Rolex. After he left the meeting, Kane walked down a series of back alleys and side streets. He kept away from the main drag just in case the royal police were still looking for him. He doubted they would bother to keep looking for a Farang who had beaten another Farang in what would surely be reported as a bar fight over a girl. And Kane had some pull with the Pattaya cops, since he already gave Police Chief Batang a cut of his smuggling revenue. Still, he saw no point in taking chances. As he walked through the rain-drenched streets, Kane felt a familiar sensation, one he knew immediately. A tingling on the back of his neck, a feeling that something was wrong. A half-heard sound, a barely glimpsed shadow, something observed on the edge of his sensory awareness told him he was not alone. He was being followed. Kane continued walking at the same pace, giving no indication to his tail that he knew anything was wrong. He turned a corner and exploded into motion, leaping over a fence made of rusted chicken wire and wooden rods. He found himself in the backyard of a tiny apartment complex. Rows of colorful sarongs and other laundry hung from a line, now soaked by the rain. Kane wondered why the owner had not brought them in once the rains had started. An empty chicken coop took up the far corner of the muddy yard, and deep puddles of murky water dotted the ground. The place seemed to be abandoned. Kane was silent as he moved around the puddles and wedged himself in a dark, tiny space behind the chicken coop. The wood of the coop was cracked and weathered. By looking through a hole in one of the side planks, he could see through the fence and observe the alley path. He doubted whoever was following him would be able to spot him. A few seconds later, Kane heard the splashing of footsteps making their way down the alley. A lone figure stood across from the abandoned apartment building, looking left and right, as if trying to determine which way Kane had gone. Kane didn't recognize the man. He was a local, with black hair and a young but tempered face. He looked over average height, and he was wearing a black wax jacket over jeans. His clothes were soaked from the falling rain. After a few minutes, the man gave up and walked further down the alley. Kane waited a moment, then leapt back over the fence. Dropping into a crouch, he stalked back down the alley until he caught sight of the man. He didn't recognize him, but he had a strong aversion to people following him, and he found himself consumed by a paranoid flame of anger. Who was this man? What did he want with him? Was he another of the Russian goons? The royal police? Or had the CIA finally caught up with him? Which of his many enemies had chosen to take action against him? There was only one way to be sure. Kane closed the distance between him and the Thai man. The alley was ending up ahead, and he had only a few seconds to make his move before they would exit onto a main street. As he moved, Kane's foot slipped on a patch of mud and dropped into a shallow puddle with an audible splash. Kane muttered a silent curse. The man spun around, his arm dropping to his rear waistband. But Kane was already moving. He slid to the man's side and slapped his reaching arm down and away. At the same time, he pivoted forward, driving a straight punch into the man's face. As his target staggered backwards, Kane slammed his forearm against the man's throat and pushed him into a tiny alcove between two buildings, out of view of the street. His target grunted in pain as his back slammed against the brick wall. Whoever the man was, he had good training. He threw up his left arm and twisted to the side, trying to break free of the pressure Kane's arm was exerting on his throat. Kane kept him pinned against the wall and drove his knee up, striking into the man's solar plexus and forcing the air from his lungs in a gasp of pain. Kane spun the man around and slammed his arm down on the back of his neck. Using his free hand, he did a quick frisk of the target's waistband and removed a Glock 19 9mm. He scanned the alley again to confirm they were alone, then pressed the gun's barrel against the man's spine. "You have something you want to say to me?" Kane hissed. "Spit it out." The man coughed and sputtered as Kane increased the pressure against his neck.
"You Mark Waters, right? My name's Satra. Satra Watana. Detective Watana. Chief Batang told me look for you."
Kane pressed harder, slamming the man's face against the brick wall. "Bullshit."
"It's true,"
Satra gasped.
"Check ID. Jacket pocket."
Kane slipped the pistol into his waistband and used his free hand to frisk the man's jacket. Sure enough, his fingers touched a slim leather badge case. He pulled it out, flipped it open, and found himself staring at a shiny metal badge, engraved with the symbol of the Royal Police. He tossed the badge onto the sodden ground. Fine. Tell Batang I pay him, and I pay him well. His cut's not getting any bigger, no matter how many dirty cops he sends my way. The man shook his head, sending a spray of rain droplets through the air.
No, not like that. I'm clean, damn it. Good cop. Batang said you have skills, training. You outsider. You can help me.
Help you do what?
Girls missing. Kidnapped. You can help me find them.
What girls? Kang growled.
Bar girls. Girls no one miss.
Kang eased up the pressure on his throat. Batang said to find me. Why? Why would I help you? The man coughed.
He say you strange man. Maybe you will help, maybe you won't. Police can't do anything. But I watch you. I see you fight for that girl the other day. I see you keep an eye on her. You protect her. Tease girls, no one look out for them. Just me.
Kang dropped his arm and stepped back. If you're lying to me, I swear. The man fell to the muddy ground, spitting and gasping for breath. He looked up at Kang, and his dark brown eyes burned hot with anger. Then the anger faded into a calm, determined stare. He took a deep breath, stood up, and looked Kang in the eye.
No lie. Follow me. We talk. I buy you beer.
Kang sighed and gestured to the street. Fine. Let's go. They stepped out of the alley, and Satra groaned as he raised his arm to hail a taxi. You want my advice? Kang said. Next time, lead with the free beer. Chapter 6. Satra took them to a local bar on the outskirts of the city. If the place had a name, Kang didn't know it. There was no sign outside, and no writing on the old, peeling door. Inside, it was little more than a shack, filled with long, splintering wood tables and round stools. The old tube television was mounted in the far corner, and a Muay Thai kickboxing match was playing on the blurry screen. The excited cheers of the audience pierced the quiet mumbling of the locals who sat at the bar. The only other sounds were the rain outside and the clinking of liquor bottles tipping into glasses. Kang walked ahead of Satra and chose a stool that faced the entrance. The bartender, a middle-aged man with a copper-tanned face and skin like leather, shouted for their order from behind the counter. Kang ordered Singha beer, and Satra asked for a glass of Mekong whiskey on the rocks. A fresh-faced teenage girl wearing jeans and a t-shirt brought them their drinks. Satra spoke to her in rapid-fire Thai. She nodded, memorizing his order. As she rushed back to the kitchen, Satra turned to Kang.
You like bar food? I ordered some gat klim, small plates. We eat, then we talk.
Kang nodded and scanned the bar. He saw no signs of danger, so he watched the kickboxing match as he sipped his cold beer. The food arrived quickly. Gap klim, or drinking snacks, consisted of a variety of small dishes that were almost always served alongside alcohol in bars. The girl set down several plates, and Kang and Satra began snacking on bites of mante praka cream, a cold salad of pickled hard-boiled eggs. A few minutes later, Kane's throat was burning from the spicy heat of pupamprik pao, crab cakes fried with eggs and a hot pepper paste. Kang cooled his fiery tongue with a long sip of beer, then set the bottle on the table. I appreciate the meal, but I don't like being followed. What's this all about? Satra was silent for a moment. Then he took a long drink of his whiskey before pulling out his cell phone.
Here, look at this.
He swiped through a series of photos. They were pictures of Thai girls, bar girls from the looks of them. All the photos appeared to be from the same kind of dating site. The site's name, Thai Angels, was written in gold letters at the top of the page. Beneath each girl's photo was a heart symbol, and next to the heart symbol was a number.
I was investigating a missing persons case. Bar girl, just 20 years old, didn't show up for work one day. Her roommate called the police when landlord complained that missing girl no pay her share of rent.
Kang leaned back in his chair. Satra, come on, you're a cop. You know as well as I do, these girls take off all the time. Maybe she went back home, or she's on vacation with a boyfriend. Satra shook his head. His dark eyes looked earnest and concerned. He furrowed his brow. I think that too, but then our technical investigation turned up this website. These are just screen captures. Real website vanish. Get taken down weeks ago. Kane looked at the pictures on the phone. Is one of these your missing girl? Satra set the phone on the table. This her. He swiped to a candid shot of a beautiful Thai girl. She was standing outside a bar, smiling at tourists in the streets. She was dressed in a skin-tight red baby tee and black patent leather hot shorts. Look here. Satra pointed to a heart symbol beneath her picture. The number next to the heart was 150. On real site, you could vote for how much you like a girl's picture. If you like how she look, you give her hots. So your girl was popular. She's pretty. No big mystery there. Satra nodded. He swiped through more photos. Of these girls on same site. This girl missing. He swiped to another photo. This girl missing too. And this one? He continued swiping through a series of 8 pictures. All the girls were beautiful, young, and dressed for work. Kane didn't recognize any of them, but he noticed that all the photos were candid shots, taken with a telephoto lens. All pretty, all buggers, all missing. And look at hearts. Kane saw that the heart count beneath each missing girl was high. 155, 129, 140. Every girl with hearts over 100 is missing, Satra said. This no coincidence. Thai Angels is no dating site. These girls are being targeted. Targeted by who? Kane asked. Satra's eyes darted around the bar, and he lowered his voice. I don't know. Website go down soon after we find it. I start talking to girls, asking around. Putting pressure on dealers, the street punks. Anyone with links to Chow Far families. You pay them off as well, yes? Kane nodded. The Chow Fa families were a loose collection of patron-run crime cartels. They were the de facto controllers of organized crime in the cities of Thailand, and anyone operating a business, legitimate or otherwise, was almost certainly paying a cut to the family that controlled their territory. You think the Chow Fa put up this website? Kane asked. I know some of the families are involved in human trafficking, but this doesn't really seem their style. Too high profile. Too much risk. Satra nodded. Maybe you're right. But soon after I start questioning, the investigation is stopped. I ordered to drop case. Kane squinted as he sipped his beer. Dropped? Why? You remember the bombing a couple weeks ago? Yeah. Muslim extremists, according to your national police chief. He paid the entire department a reward out of his own pocket, right? I thought you had a suspect in custody. Yes. He paid reward to himself and other officers. Sugar to ease bad taste of medicine. He make big announcement. Say case solved. Everything okay. But that was all lie. Satra took a sip of his whiskey. The day of explosion. Police receive a note. Say to lay off Chow Fa investigation. Stop searching for girls, or there will be more bombs. More explosions. Note was written in blood of a policeman. Man working with me. Man asking questions. Good man. He missing now, too. So, why aren't the royal police going after whoever is responsible? You'd think they'd be even more driven to catch these guys now. Satra shook his head. In Thailand, tourist industry is everything. Justice, the law, lives of few buggers, these mean nothing compared to millions of dollars tourism bring here. If more bombs explode in city, more tourists are killed. Tourists go away. Money go away. He sighed. He clenched his hand in a fist. I know you don't trust cops. Many cops here are bad, dirty. They are poor. Their salary is very little, not enough to raise a family. So they take money, look the other way. But not me. My father was police officer, and his father before him. I cannot just let this go. This is my blood. He leaned across the table. But I am only one man. Chief Patong refused to let me use police resources to find these girls. He afraid if I caught. It looked like police support investigation again. But you have skills, training. I see you fight that man.
You have connections to Chow Fa.
You can help me. You can help these girls. Kane was silent. He finished his beer and quietly set the bottle down on the table. He stared at Satra, then looked away. Satra, I can't get involved in something like this. And believe me, I'd only make it worse if I did. Satra stared at Kane.
And what about the missing girls? If they leave Thailand, no one see them again.
Kane stood up. Satra, you seem like a good guy, so take my advice. Listen to your chief, drop this case, and stop playing hero.
You can give up so easily? How can you just walk away?
I heard you out. I gave you an answer. The answer is no. Don't follow me again. Kane fished a few crumpled bot notes from his pocket and dropped them on the table. Here, drinks are on me. He turned and walked out of the bar, back into the muggy, hot air, the gray skies, and the falling rain. He walked a few blocks, letting the droplets of water soak through his hair and clothes. He forced himself to forget Satra's words and the images of the missing girls. He did not look over his shoulder as he walked through the wet, muddy streets. He knew Satra would not follow. It had all been a silly mistake. In his heart, he knew he was not the man Satra was looking for. Now, Satra knew it as well. Chapter 7. A few days later, the rain stopped, and Pattaya sprang back to life. That night, the neon lights blazed above the heads of the tourist crowd as they meandered up and down Soi 6 and other walking streets in the area. Each and every soul wandering beneath that explosion of color and light was seeking something in the hot, humid night air. Cheap beer, cheap food, cheap sex. For those seeking all of the above, Ruby's Club did not disappoint. Now that the rain had stopped, Ruby's was going out of its way to make up for lost time. Beer and drink specials were advertised all night, and the club bussed in girls from other bars to work extra shifts. Nayana smiled as she spun around the chrome pole above the main stage. She was naked, with her neon bikini top and briefs scattered on the stage below her. As she twirled around, she saw a kaleidoscope of colorful lights and faces, laughing and cheering in the shadows. The applause and music were deafening. The spinning lights danced across her body, reflecting bursts of color in the sweat, oil, and glitter that covered her skin. Sometimes she found herself overcome with the energy and excitement of the crowd. The men, the girls, the lust and decadence in the air. Sometimes she could feed off of it, drawing strength from the wild, chaotic currents of energy. Other times, that same chaos seemed to feed off her instead, devouring her piece by piece. But tonight was a good night. She felt alive, happy, with so many men in the bar. The odds were good that a few would be young, good-looking Farangs. Men with kind smiles and fat wallets that would be more than satisfied to pay her for an hour of her time. The money meant little to them, but for her and her family, it was all that kept them going. It was food for her daughter, a roof over her mother's head, medicine for her father. Her family never asked her how she provided all these things for them. They already knew, for there was only one possible answer. To speak of it would be rude and shameful. Nayana shimmied to the top of the pole and flipped upside down, hanging with her strong, tan legs. She closed her eyes, feeling the pulse of the bass vibrate over her hot, naked skin. Her thick, dark mane of hair swung through the air below her. She flexed her thighs, allowing her body to slide down the pole, slowly spiraling around it as she fell. When her hands touched the ground, she did a quick flip off the pole. She smiled, bent over, and gathered her clothes and a few crumpled bot notes from the stage. The music skipped to a new song, signaling that another girl's show was about to start. Nayana left the stage and headed for the bar. She slipped back into her bikini as she pushed through the crowd. She felt men touching her, grabbing at her, but she ignored their groping hands and kept a wide smile plastered on her face. She took a seat at the corner of the bar, and the bartender set a glass of club soda down in front of her. She sipped the cool liquid as she surveyed the crowd. After weeks of slow nights, she was anxious to book some short time. A handsome, young Farang would be nice, but right now, anyone would do.
You breaking my heart, a deep voice shouted into her ear. Beautiful woman like you should not sit alone.
She glanced back and found herself staring into a pair of large blue eyes, set in a harsh, angular face. It took her a moment to recognize the man. It was the Russian, the one from the other day. Her friend had beaten the man's hired thug to a bloody pulp. She smiled, but her eyes darted around the bar, searching the crowd for the two large bouncers that were working that night. The Russian saw her anxious eyes and smiled.
Please, let me buy you a drink. I wish to apologize. My behavior the other night, I was not exactly gentleman. Yes? Too much cheap vodka, I'm afraid.
Nyana looked sideways at the Russian as she sipped her club soda. He seemed calmer than before, but something in his gaze still set her nerves on edge.
It's not the lazy eye,
she thought. It was the intensity of his stare, the hunger behind those blue orbs set in such a dark, hard face. They reminded her of a wild dog in the street, eyeing a hunk of meat. Alexei snapped his fingers and held up a thick wad of bot notes. Nyana eyed the stack of cash with an equally hungry gaze. The bartender took notice. Within a few minutes, a vodka on ice and another lady drink for Nyana were set down in front of them. Drink in hand, Nyana spun on her stool to meet Alexei's intense stare head on.
Your friend okay?
She asked. Alexei laughed as he nodded.
Gregor? Yes, yes, he's fine. He has a few new scars, but he deserved it, no? He's a bit overprotective of me, I'm afraid. His father and mine are old friends, so we are like brothers.
She sipped her drink again, turning everything over in her mind. The bar was full. There were plenty of potential customers. But this man had money, and he desired her. He seemed to think himself important, and in her experience, self-important men tended not to last long in bed. She would be back downstairs in 20 minutes or less, with plenty of time to approach more men. She smiled and drank, pretending to listen to Alexei as he boasted of his family's heritage back in Russia. Her mind was far away, doing a series of mental calculations. And the final equation was the same as it always was. She didn't like this man, but that didn't matter in the slightest. She leaned over and let her hair graze the side of Alexei's face. She rested her hand lightly on his thigh, curling her fingers between his legs.
You handsome man. I like you. You want to go upstairs? Short time?
Alexei blinked. His eyes no longer looked hungry. They looked cold and distant. But he stood up and wrapped his thick, muscular arm around her waist. He looked down at her and smiled.
Duh. I thought you'd never ask.
Chapter 8. Kane pounded on the apartment door. Chips of red paint cracked and flaked from the force of his blows. Satra, it's me. Get up. Kane looked left and right as he knocked on the door again. The dark, narrow hallway of the apartment complex was silent and empty. If anyone was awake, they didn't seem inclined to poke their heads out to investigate the noise he was making. In this part of town, that's probably a smart call, Kane thought. He raised his hand to knock again but stopped when he heard footsteps from inside. The sound of creaking wood grew louder as they approached the door. He heard the rattle of a deadbolt turning. Then the door cracked open. A chain kept the door from swinging open all the way. Satra's face hovered into view behind the door. His eyes were half closed, and his hair was mussed and disheveled.
Watas? What the hell, man? You know what time it is?
Kane slid his foot into the doorframe. We need to talk. Let me in. Satra blinked, rubbing his eyes. He squinted at Kane.
Why? I thought you not interested in helping.
It's Nyana. She's missing.
Who?
The girl at the bar. My friend. She's missing. She cooks me dinner every week, but this time she didn't show. The bartender where she works saw her go off with that Russian again, Alexei. No one's seen her since. Satra sighed. He slid aside the security chain on the door and opened it wide enough for Kane to enter. Kane scanned the hall one more time to make sure they were alone. A nagging voice inside his head screamed at him that this was a mistake. Cops, secret investigations, some kind of half-assed rescue. All of this was madness. He was in Thailand to lay low, not to court more death and violence. Then he remembered Nyana, smiling at him in the rain.
You good friend to me,
she had said. Kane bit his lip to silence the voices in his head. He made his decision. He was operational now. There was no more room for doubt. He stepped across the threshold into Satra's tiny apartment. The Thai cop rubbed sleep from his eyes and shut the door behind him.
Welcome to my office, partner.
A couple hours later, Kane paced back and forth inside the tiny apartment, sipping coffee from a stained yellow mug. There wasn't much room to walk, as the apartment was only a single room, with a small adjoining kitchen. The windows were open, but no breeze stirred the threadbare curtains that hung over the sink. The place smelled like old takeout food and sweat. Satra sat in front of a sagging table that he had converted into a makeshift desk. Its surface was covered with cardboard boxes and manila folders, all containing files related to the case. He had told Kane that he had borrowed them from HQ, without Chief Patang's knowledge. Satra spoke a rapid-fire stream of Thai into his cell phone. He listened for a second, nodding, then stood up and paced along with Kane. When he ended the call, he dropped down to a sitting position on the futon mattress that served as a bed in the tiny room. Anything? Kane asked. Satra rubbed his face briskly with his hands, then ran them through his hair.
Word on street is new Russian mafia family in town, looking to build pipeline to smuggle girls to the west. I believe you know one of them.
Alexei Rudolph, Kane snarled.
Satra nodded.
If he buy these girls, they will leave Thailand in a few days. No one has seen Alexei or Russian since they leave Ruby Club.
We have to find him.
I just talked to my contacts. The street people, hustlers, they tell me the truth. They see Rudolph leave bar alone. No girl, no men.
Kane nodded. Same story at the Hilton. He checked out a couple hours before he was spotted at Ruby's. None of my sources place him or the other men he was with at any new hotels in the last 24 hours.
Maybe she left club on her own. Like you said, bar girls disappear all the time.
Kane shook his head. Not this one. She and I, we're close. Satra looked at Kane and raised an eyebrow. Kane shot him an angry glare. Not like that, he said. We're friends. I helped her out once. That's all.
But you risk your life in bar fights, and now you help me in illegal investigation. All for this friend? Batang was right. You are strange.
Kane set down the cup of coffee on Satra's desk and picked up a file folder. I was betrayed once. Betrayed by someone I trusted. It took me a long time to trust someone again.
And you trust her?
Kane looked up, and his green eyes glittered in the dim light. I said she's my friend. Now drop it.
Satra nodded. Okay, well, I thank you for helping. But it looked like our lead goes cold.
Kane flipped open the folder. It contained a series of photographs taken at the bombed floating market. Incinerated wood beams, black with soot, had collapsed into the muddy canal. The beautiful long tailboats that once darted across the canal's surface like dragonflies were now torn, mangled shreds of flotsam and jetsam. The river water was stained black with ash. And the bodies, they were burned and mangled almost beyond recognition. But to one who had seen such horrors before, their twisted, charred forms were instantly recognizable. One by one, he flipped through the images of death and destruction. He coldly processed the information each picture contained. The lead may be cold, but not the case. If we can't find the Russians, then we work the other side. You said the Russians are here to take delivery of human cargo. So, who's the trafficker?
Satra looked up at him thoughtfully. We've never seen anything like this website before. But the most likely culprit would be a Chowfar crime family?
Then it stands to reason they were behind the bombings.
Makes sense, sure. But which family? And where are they holding girls?
Kane held up a picture. When you investigate a crime scene, you dust for fingerprints, right? Well, explosives leave their own kind of fingerprints. See those black burn marks on the wood? That's excessive carbon that didn't burn up in the explosion. Characteristic of trinitrotoluene. Satra sighed and glared at Kane.
Also called TNT, yes? Our forensic lab is not backwards, Mr. Waters. We already investigated that angle. TNT is very common industrial explosive. Many companies use it here in Thailand. Mining companies? Chemical companies. Could have come from anywhere.
King continued to flip through the pictures. He stopped at one that showed a mangled, twisted scrap of aluminum with wires and electronics protruding like black, burned tendrils. He held up the picture for Satra to see. This is the detonator, isn't it?
We think so. Too damaged to say for sure, but it was found near center of blast. Not much left of it to go on.
Kane nodded. It's badly damaged, but look at this. See this scrap of tubing here? That's fiber optic cable. It used a laser pulse to detonate the explosive package. Highly reliable. Whoever set this off probably used a remote signal keyed from a cell phone. The signal triggers the laser, and detonation takes less than a millisecond. Satra stood and took the picture from Kane's hand. He examined it closely.
We didn't catch that. How you be so sure? This just a picture of some scrap.
Kane looked Satra in the eye. I've seen this device before. Up close. Trust me, I know.
Okay. So, fancy detonator. Hard to find. Not many people that sell this stuff here in Thailand.
Kane shook his head. No, not many at all. In fact, only one that I know of. I'll take the detonator lead. You keep looking for Alexei. I'll need a weapon. Satra opened a file box on his desk and removed a few dusty folders and stacks of paper. Underneath was a slim wood case. He lifted the lid and pulled out a battered old pistol, a Colt M1911. He handed the heavy gun to Kane. Kane gripped it and turned it side to side, hefting its weight.
This my father's gun. He carry it when he killed in line of duty.
Kane tested the magazine eject button and slide. The gun was old and battered, but its mechanisms were smooth and well-maintained. The magazine slid out with a precise, metallic click. He nodded his approval. You've taken good care of it. Thank you.
We need understanding between us, Mr. Waters. I desperate. I come to you for help. I see you have skills. I see in your eyes, you dangerous.
That good.
We face dangerous men. But we face them and bring them in for justice. Not for revenge. We good?
Kane slapped the magazine back into the pistol. He thumbed the slide release lever, and it slammed closed, readying the gun to fire. He slid the gun into his waistband and looked back at Satra. I'm not after justice or revenge, Satra. I'm just trying to help a friend. If you want my help, that will have to be good enough. Otherwise, I do this on my own. I'll call you if I find anything. Kane walked out of Satra's apartment, shutting the door behind him. As he strolled down the dark, quiet corridor outside, he wondered if his words had been true. Finding Nayana was his priority, but if those who had taken her had hurt her in any way. He thought of the devastation he had seen in the pictures, of the innocent lives these men had already taken, and the new lives they were about to destroy. Kane knew that, when he found them, he would make them pay a price for the suffering they had caused. The price would be paid in blood and pain. But was that justice? Or revenge? Kane wasn't sure what to call it. He only knew it was a certainty. That was good enough for him. Chapter 9. Eddie Ashikaga sighed as the beautiful young Thai girl standing above him pressed her fists into the knot of muscles on his back. He grunted as she began to knead the tight, sore flesh.
You know, you're stronger than you look,
Eddie said, turning his head to smile at her. The room was dark, and he could barely see the girl in the dim light. She was wearing a tight pink t-shirt with an anime cat on the front and skin-tight spandex shorts. The cat on the shirt was winking.
I like your shirt,
he said. She giggled and stopped the deep, kneading motion. Her fingers began to lightly dance over his tan skin.
Thank you. You're a strong man. Sexy body,
she said in a high-pitched voice. Eddie laughed. His scrawny, middle-aged body was not his or anyone else's definition of sexy. At 45, his jet-black hair had developed a generous dusting of white, and the bald spot in the center of his head grew larger every year. The only other part of him that was growing was his gut. But here, in a dark massage room, laying face down with a towel over his ass, he found himself inclined to believe the girl's sweet lies. The girl's fingers brushed over his right arm, tracing the intricate lines of a dragon tattoo that curved around his bicep.
Nice tattoo. Very sexy. You gangsta man?
She asked. Sure, he yawned. Yakuza, you know? Japanese gangsta. I'm a bad man. The girl began pushing down the towel. Her fingers drifted lower and lower. The soft, brushing touch moved down between his legs.
You want special massage? 500 baht only? Kimuchi,
Eddie said in Japanese.
I like. Why else would I be here?
The girl giggled again and removed the towel.
Okay, please turn over.
A man's voice called out from the darkness. For the love of God, please don't. Stay where you are, Eddie. The girl gasped. Eddie looked up, but the room was cloaked in shadows.
What the? Who the hell is that?
With a click, light bathed the room. Kane sat atop a stool next to the small table that held the girl's massage oil and other supplies. His back was against the wall, next to a curtain that led into a back room. He was pointing a gun at Eddie's head.
Eh, wait, I know you,
Eddie said, pulling the towel back around his waist.
Wata-san, Makawatas, the Yoshizawa family's gaijin pet.
The massage girl looked confused. Kane smiled at her, but his eyes were cold and focused on Eddie. He told you he was Yakuza, right? That's only part of the story. Show her, Eddie.
Look, what is this?
Eddie was cut off by the metallic click of Kane cocking his pistol. Show her, Kane repeated. Eddie sighed and pulled his right arm from under the towel. The girl gasped. Both his pinky and ring fingers were missing, severed at the first joint. You see, Kane continued. It's true that Eddie here used to be a member of the Yakuza, but they kicked him out years ago. He moved here and set up a nice little arm smuggling business for himself. Now, I've heard two conflicting stories about the missing fingers.
Come on, man. What the fu-
Version one is, Eddie sold the Yoshizawa family some explosives for a bank vault job back in Japan. But the detonator was faulty, and the charges didn't go off. The cop showed up, and he Sato Yoshizawa's hand-picked group of thieves, including his brother-in-law, got arrested and did hard time. Isato was so furious that he demanded two of poor Eddie's fingers as compensation, rather than just one. The girl began inching towards the door.
I not know him. Please, I go now?
No, Kane said in a loud, sharp voice. The girl froze. Kane's eyes softened, and he lowered his voice. I'm sorry. I promise I won't hurt you. But I need a few more minutes here, undisturbed. Just sit tight, and this will all be over soon. The girl hesitated, then nodded. Kane looked back at Eddie. Now, the other version of the story, and I'm partial to this one, is that Eddie was building a bomb for Isato himself. But he got cheap and took some shortcuts. He used a homebrewed detonator and rushed the wiring. And wouldn't you know it, the damn thing blew up in his hand. Kane shook his head, his cold, green eyes glaring at Eddie. Doesn't really matter which version is true. Either way, you are one unlucky bastard, Eddie. And it doesn't look like your luck is going to improve today. Eddie glowered at him, but did not move.
Just tell me what you want,
he said. Kane stood up and walked to the edge of the table. He kept the gun trained on Eddie as he grabbed the man's left arm. Eddie tried to yank it back, but Kane's grip was like iron. No sudden moves, Eddie. Just tell me what I want to know. You source components for a bomb that was used in the Pattaya floating market. I want to know who you were working for.
I don't know what you're talking about, man. I run guns, sure, but I don't work with explosives anymore. Never have much luck with them.
Kane twisted Eddie's hand over, so the palm faced up towards the light. The tips of his fingers were stained a yellowish orange. In World War II, women who worked with TNT in munitions factories were called canaries. Do you know why? Kane asked. Eddie was silent. It's because TNT is toxic. Prolonged exposure to its chemicals affects skin pigmentation, turns it yellow. Even short-term exposure can discolor the skin on your fingers. Takes a week or two to work through your system. So, you see, I already know you're lying. Last chance, Eddie. Kane gripped one of Eddie's yellow-stained fingers in his fist. Give me a name. Eddie looked up at him, and his eyes were wide with a mix of anger and fear.
Oro Konobaka, he hissed, calling Kane a stupid idiot.
We can't talk about this here. Let's go somewhere.
Crack. Kane jerked the finger down and back, snapping the bone.
Ah!
Eddie's scream of pain was loud and high-pitched. Kane grabbed the next finger on his hand and pressed the butt of his pistol into Eddie's spine. Give me a name, he repeated, his voice low and calm.
Please, just listen. I can't.
Crack. Again, Eddie cried out, this time a guttural, primal shriek of pain and suffering. Stop wasting my time. Name. Now. He grabbed the next finger.
Choto! Choto! Okay!
Eddie screamed.
Look, he didn't give me his name, and I didn't ask. But I met them at a house, by the beach.
Kane paused. What beach?
Nathop TM. I can write down the address.
Kane looked up at the girl. Can I borrow a pen? He asked. She opened a small drawer in the supply table and rummaged around for a second. She pulled out a crumpled old business card and a pen. Kane took them and set them on the table, next to Eddie's right hand. Do it, Kane ordered Eddie. Eddie grabbed the pen and scribbled down an address. His hand was missing two fingers, and his handwriting was almost illegible. Kane eyed the small scrap of cardboard for a second, then slid it into his shirt pocket. Thank you, Eddie. See how easy that was? Now, I highly recommend you leave Thailand for a while, at least a month or two, for your own safety. Eddie eyed him suspiciously.
Why? What are you planning to do?
Let's just say, if you stay here, I doubt your luck will get better anytime soon. If these people are who I think they are, and they find out you talked, losing a couple fingers will be the least of your worries. Leave. Tonight. Kane made his way to the door. Enjoy the rest of your massage. He slid out the door. A few seconds later, the girl scurried out of the room. Eddie wrapped the towel around his waist, sat up, and frantically began to throw on his clothes. Chapter 10. Sitting alone at an outdoor table at the Glasshouse restaurant, Kane watched as the sun sank towards the ocean. Crimson and gold reflected across the rippling water as it slipped behind the horizon. The Glasshouse was a beautiful, romantic spot, with a glass-enclosed gazebo for indoor dining. The outdoor patio was perched on a tree-lined cliff and looked out over the water, giving diners an unparalleled view of the ocean. Kane once again felt the pangs of loneliness. He realized it was foolish of him to have chosen this spot for dinner. This was a place for couples. And Kane was, as usual, alone. A pretty waitress came and took his check and payment with a bow. Kane sipped the remains of his beer, then stood up and walked towards the edge of the patio. He peered through the trees at the ocean and sandy beach that lay below. To his left, a fair distance down the beach, he could just make out the gleaming white house at the address Eddie had given him. Satra had not managed to track down the Russian's whereabouts yet, but he was able to run a title search on the address. The house was owned by a local entertainment company and used for so-called corporate housing purposes. But, as Kane has suspected, this was only the first link in the chain. Like a spider working in reverse, Satra untangled a web of holding companies and dummy corporations until he was left with a single thread. The final link in the chain led to a family with known Chow Fa ties, based out of the Chonburi province. Kane had done surveillance runs of the house earlier in the day, posing as a jogger or a tourist walking along the beach. He had spotted several men patrolling the grounds. They dressed in muscle shirts and shorts, and looked like low-level thugs. An older man with a round, pockmarked face and thinning black hair had paced outside more than once, yelling into a cell phone. Kane took him to be middle management. Kane had seen men like these before. He noted their watchful eyes, the bulges under their armpits, the flashes of a pistol butt hanging above their waistbands. Everything he saw confirmed his suspicions. Whoever owned this house, they were definitely connected to organized crime of some sort. Kane considered several ways to approach the house, including swimming in from the ocean, but with so little intel to go on, he felt the risk was too great. He had no idea how many men might be in the house. If a guard or sniper spotted him before he made it to shore, he would be an easy target. No, he thought. I need a different plan. Something unexpected. Kane pulled out his burner cell phone and dialed the number of a local escort service.
Devil's Den?
A woman's voice said on the other end. She spoke English, but with a heavy accent. Yes, I'd like to order some girls for the evening. I'll need 6. No preferences. Whomever you have available.
What hotel you at, honey?
The voice asked. No hotel, Kane answered. Send them in a limo. With a driver, please. You can pick me up at the glass house.
6 girls plus limo? Very expensive date, sir. I give you a special deal. 20,000 baht for a night. You pay advance?
Kane smiled. But of course. Kane sat in the uncomfortable silence as the limo drove down the winding beach road. Surrounding him were the 6 escorts he had ordered. They were all wearing tight dresses, mini skirts, and a variety of other provocative outfits. One of the girls, a young minx with a short bob haircut dyed bright pink, leaned against him.
Why you so stiff, huh?
She murmured into his ear.
This a party.
She pulled out a small glass vial from her purse and offered it to Kane.
You want?
No, thank you, Kane said, removing her hand from his chest. He leaned forward past a pair of giggling girls who were locked in a sensual embrace. They were most likely high on a combination of ecstasy and speed. These girls were all sourced from local bars and would have to go back to work or entertain clients like he was pretending to be for the rest of the night. They used a combination of drugs and alcohol to stay awake. He knocked on the smoke glass divider that cut off the back of the limo from the driver's section. With a mechanical hiss, the glass slid down. The driver looked back at him. Yes, sir. When we get there, just let me do the talking. My friend is a heavy sleeper, so lean on the horn and turn up the music, okay? The driver smiled.
Sure, boss. Anything you say.
He turned the knob on the stereo, and Kane felt his eardrums pulse as the heavy bass of electronic dance music thumped through the cabin. Kane smiled and gave the driver a thumbs up, which he enthusiastically returned. With a hiss, the glass divider raised back up. The limo pulled up to the gates of a white beach house. Kane opened the door. We're here. Everybody out. As the girls piled out of the limo, laughing and chattering, the limo driver began pressing the horn. Its bleating honk filled the night air, cutting through the thumping bass of the stereo speakers. The girl with the pink hair bent over the trunk of the limo and began setting up a line of white powder on a small mirror. One of the other girls squealed with excitement and ran over to join her. Another girl wearing a skin-tight black dress and 6-inch heels slinked over to Kane and grabbed his arm.
Wow, this your house, mister? You big shot, huh?
No, this isn't my house. My friend lives here. He's the one paying for the party.
You must have important friends, huh?
Let's find out, Kane said. He walked up to the gate. Its iron bars were gleaming white, like the rest of the house, and a small intercom box was mounted on a pole a few feet away. Kane pressed the intercom button. Hey! He shouted into the microphone. I'm here with the girls. The intercom crackled to life. A stream of rapid-fire Thai spat out of the speaker. The girl raised her hand to cover her mouth.
Your friend? He is very angry.
Well, he's about to get angrier, Kane said. He pressed the button again. Hey, come on. The boss ordered 6 girls and a limo. I'm here with 6 girls and a limo. Let's do this. The intercom crackled to life again. This time the voice spoke in English. We order no girls. Wrong house. You go away now. Kane turned back to the driver and gave him the thumbs up. The driver smiled and turned the music up louder. The windows of the limo rattled as the deep beats pumped through the air. Kane pressed the talk button again. Look, man, we got drugs, we got booze, and we're not going anywhere till I get paid. So get that short, pudgy little guy down here, and let's take care of business. The girl leaned over Kane's shoulder and shouted into the intercom.
Yeah, we bring the party, bitches.
You tell him, Kane said. He looked back at the limo and smiled. Whatever was going on in the house, he was sure the last thing the occupants wanted was to draw attention to themselves. And a limo full of hookers, drugs, and blasting loud music tended to draw exactly the wrong kind of attention. A few minutes later, he He saw the front door of the house open. The man with the pockmarked face and balding head, the one Kane had pegged as a manager, came storming out. He was accompanied by one of the muscle-bound thugs. The manager shook his fist and shouted at Kane and Ty. Kane adopted a relaxed pose and gave the men his best smile. "Hey, boss. Look at these girls. Beautiful, right?" The girl with the pink hair looked up and rubbed white powder off her nose. The other girls laughed.
"Come on, baby. Let's go for a ride," she said. "We show you good time, boss man."
The thug pushed a button on a small remote control that hung from his belt. The gate swung open. Kane raised his arms and turned his smile up a few watts. "See, I told you this guy likes to party." The thug walked towards him at a steady pace. He raised his arm. He was holding a pistol, aimed at Kane's head. His grip was typical gangsta style, with the barrel of the pistol pointed down and the butt tilted sideways. "Amateur," Kane thought. The girls screamed and huddled behind the trunk of the limo. The manager walked up to the driver's side window and pounded on the glass. The window lowered. He screamed at the driver and Ty. A look of fear flashed over the driver's face, and he turned down the music. Only the low chugging of the limo's engine could now be heard over the night breeze. In the distance, waves crashed on the beach, and a seagull cried from overhead. The manager turned and glared at Kane.
"You make mistake. People in this house, they want privacy. No girls, no noise, no cops. Understand? You stupid man. Leave now, or we clean up mistake."
"We clean up you, Farang. Got it?"
The man with the gun continued walking towards Kane. His eyes were covered by cheap mirrored glasses, but there was no mistaking his twisted, leering smile. Kane knew a killer when he saw one. He could see his reflection in the thug's glasses. Kane kept up his relaxed, friendly posture, but instead of backing away, he took a step towards the gunman. He raised his hand slightly, as if to signal surrender.
"Hey, boss. All good. Ladies, party's off. Let's get back in the limo."
The girls muttered to one another in scared voices as they opened the door and piled into the back of the long, black vehicle. Kane took another step forward. The gun was only a couple of feet from his head. He saw the gunman sneak a sideways glance at one of the girls as she bent over to climb into the car. It was just a fraction of a second, but it was enough. Kane's left arm shot forward and pushed the gun sideways, towards his right side. His fingers wrapped around the barrel, and he punched downwards, driving the gunman's hand down to his waist. The gun was now pointing 90 degrees to Kane's right, aimed towards the limo. He knew he had to act fast, or the gunman might squeeze off a shot and injure one of the girls in the car. Even as the gun moved downwards, his right hand was winding back. He snapped it forward, punching the thug in the face. As the man stumbled backwards, Kane let the momentum from the punch carry his arm forward, sliding along the man's arm until he felt the cold metal of the pistol. Now, both his hands held the gun in a firm grip. With a powerful twist, Kane yanked the barrel of the gun straight up. There was a loud crack as the bones in the thug's trigger finger snapped. The man screamed, and he loosened his grip on the pistol. Kane yanked the weapon away and took a step back. The thug bent over, cradling his broken finger. Kane swung the pistol butt down on the back of the man's head. He grunted in surprise and fell to the ground. Kane kneeled down, clubbing him on the head once again. The man would not be getting up anytime soon. Panting, he turned and pointed the gun at the manager. "You, take out your wallet." The manager froze, barely able to comprehend the sudden explosion of violence he had witnessed. His beady eyes glared at Kane with surprise and fear.
"You crazy! You tried to rob this house?
Do it." The man fumbled for his wallet and held it out to Kane. Not moving, Kane kept his gun aimed at the manager. "All your cash. Give it to the girls. They deserve a tip." The man did as he was told, taking several thousand baht notes from his wallet and holding it out towards the limo. The rear window rolled down, and the girl with the pink hair grabbed the cash. The limo roared to life, kicking up dust as it drove in a circle around them and then tore off down the beach road. Its red taillights disappeared over a hill. Kane was alone with the man in front of the house. He walked over to the short, pudgy man, spun him around, and frisked him. The man was unarmed. Kane took a step back. "What's your name?" The man was silent for a moment, but then spat out, Lao. Lao Samchai. Kane pushed his shoulder with the barrel of the gun. The man stumbled forward. Okay, Lao, Kane said. I want to talk to your boss. Chapter 11. Kane clenched the fabric of Lao's shirt in his right hand and the gun in his left as he followed behind the shorter man. He pivoted left and right, keeping Lao between himself and the other thugs that stared at them as they made their way through the house. It was dark outside now, and the interior was dim, lit only by the occasional lamp or flickering TV. The house was modern, contemporary in style and decorated almost entirely in white. The hired muscle, in their cheap shirts and knockoff jeans, looked out of place in the gleaming, pristine surroundings. Lao led him out of a set of sliding glass doors and down a staircase to a blue-tiled patio. The sound of waves was louder now. The beach was somewhere out in the darkness. Turning left, they walked down another flight of stairs. At last, they emerged beside a shimmering, rectangular swimming pool. The lights from the pool reflected across the water, casting a rippling glow over the patio. A figure was hunched in a white plastic chair. A few other chairs were set up around the outdoor patio table. The figure was facing a large, flat-screen TV that had been set up on a stand. A dirty orange extension cord ran from the TV into the house, powering the Thai soap opera that flickered on the enormous screen. You one crazy Farong, Lao whispered as they walked towards the dark figure. You get in here, no problem. But you never get out. You die here. Just introduce me, Kane muttered. He spotted several gunmen perched on the balcony above them, training their weapons on him. He realized Lao might be correct. If things did not go well, it was unlikely he would leave this house alive. As they reached the table, Lao dropped to his knees. The pudgy little man bowed, touching his head to the ground. Chao Mei, forgive me. I fail you. The figure in the chair turned to face them. Kane was surprised to see an elderly woman's face eyeing him with dark, sunken eyes. She was dressed in a pink robe over her fluffy, white slippers. A silk scarf held back her stark white hair, although a single gray curl flopped across her wrinkled forehead.
Yes, you have failed me, Lao, the woman said. How many times have I told you? Never interrupt my dramas.
Her voice was low and raspy. Kane could hear years of smoking and drinking in the harsh, scratchy tone. Her eyes darted back and forth over his face, like a serpent's tongue.
Who the hell are you?
Kane eyed the old woman, but kept his gun trained on Lao. My name is Mark Waters. The woman turned away and poured herself some tea from a metal pot on the table.
Ah, I'm old enough to know a lie when I hear one. But what do I care? None of my business what you write on your tombstone. You can call me Anna. Sit and have some tea, while things are still civil.
Kane watched as several gunmen moved down to the pool. They hung just out of the light, keeping their weapons aimed at him from a distance. He shrugged and walked over to the table. Whoever this woman was, the men seemed to be protecting her. His best chance to survive was to stay close to her. She made a waving motion with her hand, and Lao stood up. He glared at Kane, then turned and shuffled back into the house. Kane sat down in one of the patio chairs and placed the gun on the table, making sure to keep it out of the old woman's reach. Anna sat to his right. Across the table from him, sitting in the free chair, was a small doll. The doll was exactly the same size as a young human girl. Its porcelain skin had a pink, glossy sheen to it. Thick black hair fell to its shoulders, and Kane was certain the strands were real, human hair. Its plastic eyes sparkled, reflecting the rippling glow of the pool. The thing almost looked alive in the dim, shifting light, and Kane found the effect unnerving. The doll was dressed in expensive, designer clothes. A plate of real food sat on the table before it. Anna flashed him a toothy smile and poured him a cup of tea. She poured another cup and set it before the inanimate figure.
This is my Luke Tep. Her name is Tia. Say hello to Tia, Mr. Waters.
Kane turned his gaze from the doll to the old woman. It's a doll.
It is not a doll. It is a Luke Tep. Do you know what that means?
Kane shook his head.
It means child angel,
the woman rasped.
She was blessed by a Buddhist priest. She's not a toy. She's a talisman. Now say hello. or I'll have my men flay you alive.
Kane turned to the doll. Hello, Tia. Pleased to meet you. He spoke as if he were talking to a small child. The woman smiled and turned back to the TV.
Damn, now I'm lost. You picked an inconvenient time to disturb me, Mr. Waters.
Kane took a sip of tea. The woman is deranged, he thought. He would have to proceed carefully. I was expecting to find a Chowfa grandfather in this house. She gave him a shrewd smile.
Instead, you found a godmother. The correct term is Chow Mei. Surprised?
Kane nodded, pleasantly.
We'll see. I haven't decided if you get to live or not. What are you doing here?
Kane reached into his pocket, noting the way the gunmen surrounding them tensed up. They relaxed when he pulled out his burner phone. He had saved digital copies of the pictures Satra had shown him on his memory card. He called up the pictures and slowly slid the phone over to Anna. This website, Thai Angels. I believe the Chowfa are running it. These girls have been taken. The woman picked up the phone and flipped through the pictures.
Your chances are getting worse, Mr. Waters. I don't see why I should care about some kidnapped bar girls.
I want them back. That's why I came here. The woman put down the phone and squinted at him. Her face was cold and still. She gave Kane the impression of a gargoyle statue. Cold, lifeless, and eternal.
Why?
She asked.
Why do you want them back? What are they to you?
That doesn't matter, Kane answered quietly. Again, the woman uttered her raspy chuckle.
I think you will find it matters a great deal.
Kane leaned back in his chair. Anna, obviously you are a powerful woman. I don't want to make an enemy of you. I mean no disrespect, but please believe me when I say I have fought my way into and out of worse places than this. Anna nodded.
Yes, yes. You've got balls, and you've got skill. I'll give you that. You're what, a con man? A smuggler? Some kind of too-big criminal? Or at least you're pretending to be. And yet you're risking your life sitting here at my table, looking for these girls. Girls are a dime a dozen in Pattaya, so I know this isn't a business transaction, which means this is personal, isn't it? You want to save them. Save them from some horrible fate worse than death. Yes? What are you? Some kind of guardian angel?
Kane stared at her, but said nothing. Anna's voice grew even more dry and raspy.
But the way you took care of my men, fought your way into this house, I can see by the look in your eyes, you've watched men die. It leaves a mark on you. Blood always stains.
Kane shifted in his chair. I'm sure you've seen your share of blood, Anna. The old woman nodded.
Oh, yes. Take it from me. Whatever your name is, you can be both an angel and a devil for only so long. Sooner or later, you have to choose one.
Kane reached out to grab the phone, and Anna slammed her hand on top of his. The movement was sudden and powerful, and Kane was shocked the old woman could move so quickly. Her stare pierced him like icy nails.
If you wait long enough, Mr. Waters, one will choose you.
She released his hand, and he took back his phone. As I said, I don't want to make an enemy of you, Kane replied. But I warn you not to make an enemy of me. I'm not looking to save the world. I just want these girls back. I'll do whatever it takes to get them. Anna nodded. She turned her attention back to the TV.
This actress is lovely, don't you think? She plays the mother of the wealthy businessman. She's a real dragon lady, the power behind his throne, so to speak. He wants to marry the common girl from town, but the mother has already arranged for him to marry his business rival's daughter.
As Anna rattled on about the plot of the drama, a servant emerged from the house to clear their dishes. He removed the plate of food in front of Anna's doll and replaced it with a small dish that held a colorful assortment of macaroons. When the police tried to investigate this website, your people set off a bomb in the floating market. How many real children did you kill there? Kane asked in a cold, flat voice.
Oh, bullshit,
Anna snapped. Her nostrils flared with anger and indignation.
My people did not set off any bombs. Whoever led you here is covering their tracks. You've been played, Mr. Waters. That website isn't run by me or any other Chow Fa family.
You expect me to believe the Chow Fa doesn't engage in human trafficking? Kane asked.
Yes, I traffic women. Poor girls from shit towns come to me, desperate for a new life, willing to do anything to make enough money to feed their families. Do I profit off their misery? Certainly. I'm not going to apologize for that to a man like you. We both know you've done far worse, and you don't have as many years behind you as I do. Am I wrong?
Kane returned her stare, waiting for her to continue.
I ship them all over the world, and they do what they have to. It's not pretty. Survival never is. But kidnapping local girls, auctioning them off like cattle, that's not only shameful, it's bad business. Too much risk. Sends people like you to my door.
Why should I believe you? Kane asked. Anna twisted her dry, cracked lips into a smile.
Because I can prove it to you. I can tell you who is really running the site. And, with a little luck, where to find your precious bar girls.
Kane leaned forward in his chair. Where are they?
Not so fast,
Anna cackled.
I'm not in the habit of giving out information for free. There's a price. And you did say you would do whatever it takes, didn't you?
Kane glared at the leathery old woman. Fine. How much do you want? Anna smiled again.
Do I look like I need your money? No, no. Keep your bot. You have skills, connections. You were able to find me here. I want you to put those skills to work for me. A favor, chosen by me at a later date. Nothing too far south of your moral compass. I promise. We have a deal, yes?
Kane hesitated for a moment, then nodded. Deal. Anna spit in her hand and held it out to Kane. He shook it.
Good.
The old woman took a deep, wheezing breath.
Now, the people running that website are not Chow Fa. They are Red Wah. Have you heard of them?
Kane thought for a second. Drug runners. They operate in the hills, on the northern border. Refugees and immigrants from the United Wa State, an independent territory in Burma. Or I guess I should say, Myanmar now. Anna nodded.
You are well informed. The Chow Pa have had good relations with the Red Wa in the past. We both have Chinese ancestry in our blood. We have a partnership in meth trade here in Thailand.
So, why are you selling them out to me? Kane asked.
One of their number, a man we call Pizak, has been muscling in on our territory here in Pattaya. Massage parlors, brothels, beer bars. He has overstepped his bounds. These are Chow Fa operations. Pizak believes his contributions to our drug trafficking success have earned him a cut of profits from our other operations. We do not share his belief.
Pizak? Kane asked.
It means devil. Whatever you may think of me, I promise you, this man lives up to the name.
I don't believe in devils or demons, Anna. The old woman shrugged.
As you like. Anyway, I used to do business with the Rudolph family. They are old-school Russian mafia. A Vor family. The father, Sergei, was recently released from prison. Just before his release, Alexei Rudolph, his son, cut ties with us. We believe he is now working with Pizak and the Red Wa. They set up the Thai Angel site together. Handpicked girls. Pretty, sexy bar girls. Not filthy village peasants with crooked teeth and scrawny bodies. Girls like this, men see, men desire. Now, they can have them, with the click of a button.
Anna shook her head.
Shameful.
I had a run-in with Alexei Rudolph. He's disappeared.
He's probably gone to the Red Wa camp to take possession of the girls. They will be locked into a cargo container and loaded onto a ship. No way out, no sunlight. Pitch black darkness. Maybe they have a flashlight so they don't piss and shit on each other. Whatever food and water Pizak provides for them, it won't be enough. Some will most likely die on that journey. Maybe they will be the lucky ones.
Where is the camp? Kane asked, his eyes glowing with anger. Anna turned her attention back to the TV. Her show had ended. On screen, the credits rolled over a still frame image, a Thai man and woman, holding each other in a passionate embrace.
Damn, I missed the whole show. You really fucked up my night, Mr. Waters.
Where are the girls? Kane asked, his voice louder than before. Anna picked up a remote and turned the TV off. The screen went dark.
I don't know. Let me check with my people. Leave your contact information with Thou inside the house. We will send you a location within 24 hours, and you can rush off to save your lovelies, assuming you survive. Per our agreement, you will do a favor for me, yes?
That was the deal. Kane stood up to leave.
Say goodbye to Tia,
Anna snapped, her voice hard as steel. You know, these bar girls do what they do to feed their families, and you sit in this house wasting a fortune on food and tea for a doll. Anna looked up at him, and a ripple of anger flashed in her black eyes.
I told you, she's a loop tap. She was blessed by a priest. That means she has a soul. She is like a daughter to me.
The missing girls are someone's daughters, too. Anna's expression hardened.
Do you have children?
Kane shook his head. No, I don't. Anna reached out and stroked the doll's hair.
A thankless child is sharper than a serpent's tooth. I don't have to worry about that with Tia. She is a blessing. She brings me luck. Perhaps she will bring you luck, too. You need it, Mr. Waters.
Without responding, Kane walked back into the house. Behind him, Anna remained, sitting with her blessed doll while the waves lapped at the beach in the darkness. Chapter 12. Kane caught a taxi back to the walking street area of Pattaya. He walked through the crowds of pleasure-seeking tourists amid the flickering neon lights until the streets turned dark and the crowds thinned out. The gleaming clubs and go-go bars were replaced with rickety tenements and rotting apartment buildings. This was Satra's neighborhood. Glancing around the street to make sure he was alone, Kane pulled out his cell phone and dialed the detective's number. The phone rang twice, and Satra picked up.
Hey, where you been?
I got some information on the Russians. I believe they're up north, somewhere along the Myanmar border.
Who tell you that?
I met with someone high up in the Chow Fa. It's a long story, but according to my contact, the Chow Fa aren't the ones behind the website. It's the Red Wa, and they're working with the Russian mafia.
You believe them?
Kane paused. Not sure, but they could have killed me. Instead, they let me go. Either way, it's the best lead we have right now. Satra sighed.
Well, it matched what I find. Finally got a line on Russians. Witness saw them charter a private plane. They fly to Chai Mei, up north. They rent vehicle there, 4x4 truck. Good for dirt roads. Maybe they going into jungle.
That must be it, Kane said. My contact said Alexei is working with a man known as Pizak. His camp is up north. They're sending me coordinates soon. Satra whistled.
I have heard of this man. I thought he was just myth, a fairy tale. If we can get evidence, link Pizak to this case, Chief Patang will have to investigate. He have no...
Kane heard Satra gasp, and then there was a loud crash. Satra! Satra, are you there? The line went dead. Kane jogged down the street faster and hit the redial on the phone. The phone rang. No one picked up. Kane jammed the phone in his pocket and broke into a sprint. He felt the blood roaring in his ears as he drove his legs faster across the pavement. It might have been a bad connection, or it might have been a dead battery. In his heart, Kane knew it was neither of those things. The people they were investigating had set off a bomb in a public market and killed dozens of people, simply to discourage the police from investigating them. They were ruthless and willing to act. Satra had been turning over rocks, questioning anyone he could find about them. If word had gotten back, if just one of his contacts had squealed, Satra was in terrible danger. Kane was panning as he raced around the corner onto Satra's block. His apartment building was just ahead, on the left side of the street. Kane ducked behind a battered red pickup truck that was parked on the side of the road. As he caught his breath, he peered around the rear corner of the truck. The street was dark and quiet. A couple of streetlights pierced the sweltering darkness with their hazy glow, but there was still more shadow than light. Kane moved out again, walking at a normal pace. He jammed his hands in his pockets, trying to look like a lost tourist. His eyes glanced left and right, but he saw no signs of movement. He made his way to the front of Satra's building. A few squares of light were shining from apartments that faced the street, but most of the building was dark. Either it was empty, or the majority of the tenants were early sleepers. Kane scanned the premises one last time, but still saw no signs of a disturbance. No movement of any kind. Walking up to the outside gate, he slipped a small lockpick from a pouch under his belt. He had picked the lock before, the first time he had visited the detective. It did not take him long to pick it again. A few minutes later, the door creaked open on its rusty hinges. Kane took a step forward. The air around him ignited in a blast of heat and fire. Boom! The explosion was deafening. Kane felt the hot air scald his skin as the force of the blast threw him backwards. He closed his eyes and forced his body to go limp. He hit the ground 10 feet back and tumbled away from the burning building. As he rolled, he raised his hands and covered his head. Shards of wood and glass pelted the ground around him like shrapnel. A huge chunk of burning timber slammed into the ground less than a foot from his head. The pavement crumbled beneath it as it rolled to a stop. Kane leapt up from the ground and sprinted as far from the burning rain of debris as he could. The telltale patter of objects striking the ground subsided. Kane stopped and turned around. Satra's building was gone. A skeletal framework still stood, but the center of the apartment complex had collapsed into crumbling rubble. Wreckage was strewn about the ground, as if the entire structure had been thrown into the air and slammed back to the earth upside down. What little remained was engulfed in fire. Thick, gray clouds of smoke rose up from the flames and blotted out the stars in the night sky. There was no way anyone inside the building could have survived. Kane had seen enough explosions to be certain of that. Whoever had planted the charges had done their work well. Pizak's death toll had just increased. The moaning wail of sirens rose in the distance. Kane stared at the flames. For a moment, he wondered if Satra had been dead or alive, conscious or mercifully numb when the burning, hungry flames had consumed him and everyone else around him. Was he forced to listen to the screams of the other tenants over the loud crackling of burning wood and superheated metal? The sirens grew louder, closer. Kane could barely hear them over the turmoil of thoughts that raced through his head. What if he had agreed to help Satra sooner? What if he could have stopped these people before they had taken Nyana, before they got wind of Satra's investigation? The sirens were just around the corner now. Kane took a few steps backwards, then turned and walked into the thick darkness that surrounded the burning building. Within a few seconds, he was gone, lost in the shadows. Chapter 13. Kane rolled the heavy wood door of the boathouse open and looked inside. Behind the door, darkness stared back at him. The pier had no lights of any kind, and only the moon illuminated the grounds after the sun set. At the moment, the moon was hidden behind a thick bank of clouds, leaving the boathouse shrouded in darkness. He had rented the boathouse under an assumed name, and he had used a cutout from one of the local street gangs to pay the owner in cash for the year. There was nothing to tie the property back to him. Still, he clicked on a small mag light and swung the brilliant, tiny beam through the interior, checking every shadowed nook and cranny for intruders. The dark, musty wood shack was empty. He stepped inside, closed the door behind him. Taking a length of chain that hung from the inner wall, he looped it around the door handle and slid a heavy-duty combination lock through the chain links. He was confident no one would be able to enter without making enough noise to warn him first. An old fishing boat sat in the center of the boathouse, upright and perched on a single-unit dry rack. It was about 20 feet long and looked to be in terrible shape. A lumpy crust of barnacles coated its hull, and years of salt corrosion and neglect had stripped away the paint. It would have cost a small fortune to refit the vessel and make her seaworthy again, but Kane didn't care about that. He had no intention of ever putting this rotting carcass of a boat in the water. Kane grabbed a small utility ladder and dragged it over the edge of the boat. He climbed up the ladder and hopped onto the main deck. The floorboards flexed and groaned under his feet, but they supported his weight. He stepped into the small cabin at the stern of the boat. The beam of his flashlight filled the cabin with a soft, warm glow. Kneeling, he felt along the floorboards until he located the tiny pressure plate he had installed between two of the boards. He pressed the catch until he heard it click and felt one of the boards lift a fraction of an inch. Using his fingernails, he was able to pry it up, revealing a metal door hidden beneath the floor. He removed several more floorboards, each one exposing more of the metal hatch. Finally, he removed the last board, and a small numeric keypad came into view, mounted next to a thick metal handle. The object was a safe, its door facing up towards him. Kane typed in a series of letters and numbers into the keypad. A small light next to the safe's handle turned green. Kane grabbed the handle and pulled. The heavy metal door lifted up, revealing its contents. The glow of the halogen bulb glinted off the metal stocks and barrels of a small arsenal of modern weaponry, a variety of pistols, rifles, submachine guns, and knives were neatly arranged in the safe, along with several other bags of supplies and an assortment of ammunition. Kane had stashed the equipment here in case his old friends at the CIA ever came looking for him. Now, he would put it to use for another purpose. He began to select weapons and lift them from the safe, laying them out on a small workbench that ran along one side of the cabin. After a few minutes, he stood back and surveyed the gear on the bench. First up were a pair of SIG P226 pistols chambered in 9mm. Next to them sat an H&K MP7 submachine gun with folding forward grip and retractable shoulder stock. Several extended capacity magazines were stacked next to the weapon. Finally, he set a Spyderco paramilitary two-folding knife with a blackened steel blade down on the bench, along with a sharpening stone. He spent the next couple hours loading magazines and field stripping the weapons. Then he cleaned and oiled their firing mechanisms and reassembled them. The work was tedious, but that didn't bother him. It kept his mind off other things. The glow from the flashlight was dim, but he had trained to perform these actions blindfolded if need be. He knew every spring and switch, every curve of metal. He knew each weapon as intimately as a lover. He had just begun grinding the knife's blade across the sharpening stone when a beep from his phone interrupted his concentration. He put the knife down to check the phone's screen. He had a text. He opened it, finding coordinates in a file attachment for a map. There was also a message.
My contact says the girls will be loaded onto a cargo ship in 24 hours.
True to her word, Anna had sent him the location of Pizak's camp. Kane opened the map file and checked the coordinates. They were north of Chiang Mai, just inside the Thai border with Myanmar. That matched the intel from Satra. Alexei Rudolph was heading north. Pizak would be there to meet him. Nayana and the other girls would be there as well. For 24 hours, at least. After that, Kane tapped the edge of the knife's blade with his thumb and felt it bite his skin. A tiny droplet of blood swelled from the cut. Kane licked his thumb clean before folding the knife closed. Okay, he thought. Time to go to work. Chapter 14. Kane felt his muscles cramp and ache as he lay still in the underbrush of the jungle. An uncountable number of insects, birds, and other creatures of the night chirped, squawked, and growled, creating a strange, primal symphony. Despite this background of noise, the dark foliage he was concealed in felt still and unmoving. It had taken hours to drive from Pattaya to Chiang Mai. Once there, he had purchased some necessary clothes and supplies. After wolfing down a bowl of Khao Sai noodles and minced pork served by a street vendor, he had rented a battered, old truck. Then he had loaded his heavy black duffel bag of weapons and the newly purchased supplies into the back. He'd driven the truck roughly 60 miles north, following the coordinates Anna had given him, to the Meiping River. A fishing barge had taken him across the river for a few baht coins. Now, after countless hours of nonstop travel and movement, he lay deathly still, looking out over the dark valley. A small tributary of the larger river snaked its way west, cutting through the thick jungle canopy below. Kane had held this position for over an hour. A pair of compact night vision binoculars were pressed up against his eyes. He turned his head back and forth, scanning the dark green curve of the river. He had spotted a series of buildings on the northern bank. They looked like shacks, hastily constructed from scrap wood and sheets of corrugated metal. A few rust-covered trucks and jeeps were parked around the camp. A small campfire burned in a clearing between the buildings, a brilliant, white-hot point of light in his goggles. Glowing green figures crouched around the fire, cooking skewers of meat and boiling water in metal pots. Anna's coordinates were correct. This had to be the Red Wall camp. He adjusted his binoculars and peered deeper into the darkness, sweeping back and forth between the buildings. He counted at least 12 men outside. Three guards were clustered around a wooden, fence-like structure. Kane zoomed in closer. He could see several figures moving within the fenced-in area. A few more were lying on the ground. It was difficult to tell through the night vision lenses, but Kane was certain they were the missing girls. He was not too late. There was still time. Kane slipped the binoculars into a pouch that hung from his waist. He was dressed in a black t-shirt and cheap black jeans he had purchased in Chiang Mai. His weapons were stored in a waterproof pack he carried on his back. He slid across the ground, making no sound as he moved. His muscles cramped, and bits of branches and rock tore at his skin as he dragged his prone body over them. The river was his goal, and he had to move slowly to avoid detection. An inch at a time, closer and closer. By the time he made it to the riverbank, his body was covered in muck. Bits of grass and foliage clung to his face. He lay still, letting his weight sink into the mud. He observed the camp, listening for any noise that sounded out of place, any sign that he had been spotted. But the only sound was the rhythmic rise and fall of the jungle animals, chirping and squawking as before. He took a deep breath and shimmied forward into the cold water. A slight current stirred the river's murky surface. Kane allowed it to push him a few yards downstream, towards the western edge of the camp. Then he dove down and swam underwater. His long, powerful kicks propelled himself through the liquid darkness. An experienced diver, Kane could hold his breath for a long time. But here, in this dark jungle river, infested with snakes and even crocodiles, he found himself rushing to reach the opposite shore. Since leaving Pattaya, he had been running on adrenaline and luck. He knew it was only a matter of time before either ran out. When his grasping fingers scraped across mud and reeds, he knew he had reached the opposite riverbank. Kane lifted his head a fraction out of the water, just enough to take a slow, shallow breath. Then, once again, he crept forward inch by inch. He was careful to slide across the stiff reeds without snapping them as he emerged from the river. Keeping low, he made his way to a line of trees at the edge of the camp. He could see the flickering campfire now, and make out the shadowy forms of the men surrounding it. The fire would limit their vision to a few feet. So long as he stayed in the penumbra surrounding the light, he would be invisible to them. Circling around the trees, he stalked towards the fenced-in area. It sat near the northern edge of the camp, the point farthest away from the river. Kane paused behind another clump of trees and vines as he observed the area. The fence was constructed from sharpened bamboo poles, each placed a few feet apart in the ground. Lengths of barbed wire ran between each pole, and coiled razor wire ran along the top of the fence. There was a small gate at the front of the pen, and a thick padlock kept it locked shut. Two of the men stood guard at the front, while a third was circling the pen. Kane watched as the man passed a few feet away from him, completely oblivious to his presence. Kane let his arm drop to his side. His fingers curled around the Spyderco knife. He slid his thumb into the hole stamped into the closed blade. With a quick flick of his wrist, the knife snapped open. The guard was a few feet ahead of his position, staring into the pen, watching the girls. Kane accelerated, taking short, rapid steps to muffle the sound of his running. As he closed in, the guard spun around, and Kane saw him raise a battered automatic rifle. But he was too late. Kane knocked the barrel aside and drove the blade of the knife up and into the man's throat. The guard's eyes bulged, and blood spurted from his neck. Kane slid behind him and clamped a hand over the man's mouth, muffling his cries. Dropping low, he dragged the man back into the underbrush. As he moved, he twisted the knife, ripping open the wound more. allowing the blood to rush out faster. Kane waited until the man's struggles began to die down. After a few minutes, the guard stopped kicking and thrashing and lay still. Kane grabbed the fallen man's rifle, removed the clip, and tossed them both into the jungle. Then he searched the corpse. He pocketed a Leatherman utility tool and a small metal key that hung around the man's neck on a frayed cord. Then he covered the body with vines and scraps of vegetation. He made his way back to the cage. Kneeling down next to one of the bamboo poles, he tapped the blade of the knife against the wood. The sound was barely audible above the jungle noise. He tapped again. A dark figure crawled over to him, investigating the sound. It was a girl. She looked about 20. Her clothes were filthy and tattered, and her face was streaked with dirt and blood. An ugly purple bruise surrounded her left eye. Someone had beaten her. Her eyes shot wide open when she saw him, and Kane realized he was covered in blood from the guard he had killed. He raised a finger to his lips in the universal gesture for silence. He nodded towards the gate and the two remaining guards, standing just out of sight in the darkness. The girl was still for a moment. A look of fear froze on her face, like a deer caught in headlights. She looked over her shoulder at the guards, then back at Kane. She hesitated a few more seconds, then crawled towards him. She pressed her face against the bars.
"Who are you?"
she whispered.
"You help us? Get us out of here?"
Kane shushed her and whispered back even quieter, "Where's Nyana?" The girl pointed over her shoulder. Kane nodded. The girl understood. She crawled back to the group of girls. Their whispers rose to an audible chatter, and Kane cursed under his breath. The guards were sure to take notice before long. Another face crawled towards him from the darkness. It was Nyana. She saw him and covered her mouth with her hands. Again, Kane raised his fingers to his lips. "It's okay," he whispered. "Keep quiet. I'm going to get you out of here."
"Oh my God."
Her eyes began to tear up.
"How you find me?"
Kane shook his head. "Later. Here." He slid the key into her hands. "I took this from a guard. Is this the key to the gate?" Nyana nodded as she wrapped her hands around his and took the key. Nyana reached a hand through the fence and touched his face.
"I knew you would come."
Kane removed her hand and slipped the utility tool into her fingers.
"Here, take this too. It has a knife, just in case,"
he whispered.
"I'll distract the guards. When the time comes, you have to move fast. Get across the river, hide on the other side of the valley. I'll find you. If I'm not there in 30 minutes, try to find the closest village."
"How I know when to go?"
she asked. Kane twisted his lips into a grim smile.
"Trust me, you'll know."
He gave Nyana a reassuring smile, then crept back into the shadows. Chapter 15. Kane made his way through the dark shadows that hung around the perimeter of the Redwa camp. He circled behind one of the small wood shacks and dropped prone. The shack was raised about a foot off the ground, and a small creek flowed through the muddy ground beneath it. A bucket hung from a hole in the floor of the shack. It floated in a lazy circle on the dark, still water of the creek. On the other side of the shack, Kane could see the rubber tires of a jeep. It was parked a few feet away from the building's entrance. The vehicle stood between him and the campfire, where several of the men crouched and chattered among themselves. From the excitement in their voices, Kane guessed they were playing a game, gambling of some kind. He slid forward through the brush, making his way under the shack. The water from the creek was shallow, but he had to crawl at a snail's pace to avoid splashing. The mud was cold and sticky, a welcome relief from the oppressive heat and humidity of the jungle above. As Kane slid past the bucket, he stopped moving and listened. The building above sounded empty, and only a dim light shone down from the hole. Ahead, beyond the parked jeep, the men continued their chatter, occupied by their game. He slid out from under the shack. For a few seconds, he was exposed, out in the open. If any guards had been watching from the shack or walking past the area, but Kane's luck held. No one walked by. The men were still gathered around the campfire. He moved under the jeep and rolled over onto his back. Grabbing his knife, he cut two lengths of hose from the undercarriage. Then he pulled himself out from under the vehicle. He crept along the side of the jeep, keeping it between himself and the campfire. He unscrewed the gas cap. Working quickly, he inserted the longer hose, a thin black rubber tube he had ripped from the coolant system, into the gas tank. Next, he inserted the shorter length, a thick red hose crusted with old grease and engine oil. Once the hoses were in place, he used his knife to cut off a scrap of his t-shirt and stuffed it between the two hoses. When the seal around the hoses was as airtight as he could make it, Kane wrapped his lips around the shorter hose. He winced as the taste of dirt and grime filled his mouth. He blew short, rapid puffs of air into the tank. As the air pressure rose in the vehicle's gas tank, it forced the fuel out, and there was only one place for it to go. A thick trickle of gasoline began to spurt from the end of the other hose. Kane grabbed the thin black tube. He sprayed as much of the vehicle's tires as he could with the gasoline, and soaked the ground beneath the Jeep with the volatile fuel. When the tank was empty, Kane crawled back under the shack. He shimmied through the mud to the hanging bucket and used it to pull himself up through the hole in the floor. As he surfaced, he swept the area with his pistol, peering into the shadows for any signs of movement. The small building was empty. Plastic tarps covered stacks of building materials, but no guards were present. A single lantern hung near the door, bathing the room in a soft, flickering glow. Kane holstered his pistol and unslung the MP7 submachine gun that hung by a shoulder strap at his side. With rapid, practiced motions, he extended the stock and flipped down the front grip. He made his way to the door, grabbing the lantern, and took a deep breath. Then, Kane kicked open the door and tossed the lantern towards the Jeep. A gigantic fireball blasted up into the dark sky. Kane took cover behind the doorframe. The men outside began to shout and scream. Peering around the corner, he saw shadowy figures running towards the burning Jeep. He pushed away from the building and opened fire with the submachine gun. Multiple rounds of high-velocity ammunition penetrated the lead guard, and his body danced and jerked from the impact. Kane could see splatters of blood fly from his body, lit up bright red by the brilliant glow of the burning Jeep. He ducked back behind the door as another guard opened fire with an AK-47. The powerful bullet shredded the thin walls of the shack. Kane clenched his teeth as he felt trails of hot air streak past his face, missing him by only a few millimeters. Kane backed up, taking cover behind one of the tarp-covered stacks. His visibility was now limited to the rectangle of the doorframe. He fired blind, sending a hail of bullets out into the darkness. He heard footsteps rushing towards him. He popped up from his cover and fired again. His burst cut down an overeager guard who had charged from the entrance of the shack. The guard spun and fell face down on the floor. Kane ducked back down and ejected the empty magazine from the MP7. As he slammed more ammo into the weapon, he heard the shattering of glass, and then a whoosh. The crackling noise of fire filled the room. Kane turned and saw the corpse in the entrance of the shack ignite in flames. One of the men outside had thrown a Molotov cocktail into the entrance. The tiny wood building was burning. Kane stood up and sprayed a long burst of automatic fire out the door. He saw another man drop, and the remaining guards scattered. They took cover behind other buildings in the camp. He coughed as thick, hot smoke began to fill the tiny room. Tongues of fire snaked up the doorframe, engulfing the entrance of the shack in a wreath of flame. Kane emptied the MP7 into the rear wall of the shack. The bullets chewed through the thin wood wall as if it were paper. He let the gun hang to his side as he began to kick the wall down. He knew he could slip back down into the creek if need be, but he didn't want to take the chance of the burning building collapsing on top of him. It took only seconds to kick a large hole in the shredded wall. Kane leapt through, hit the ground, and rolled. Behind him, the burning shack began to sag and dip as the fire tore through its thin wood structure. Sparks and burning embers drifted up into the air, like a cloud of tiny fireflies. He heard footsteps running towards him. Drawing his pistol, he jogged over to an outcropping of trees and took cover. The crackle of automatic weapon fire burst through the air. Muzzle flash from multiple weapons lit up the jungle. He returned fire with his pistol, sending double taps towards each firing position. He looked back into the camp towards the fenced-in cage. The gate was open. The pen was empty. Nayana and the girls had escaped. He moved deeper into the jungle surrounding the camp. A cluster of bullets splintered a tree to his right, sending a fine shrapnel of wood fragments into the air. A shard struck his face, and he tasted blood. He returned fire and heard screams of pain echo from the darkness. Kane moved again, running through the jungle. Occasionally, he turned and fired into the darkness. He was just covering his retreat now, hoping to slow his pursuers. Up ahead was the river. If he could make it across, he knew he could lose them in the thick jungle valley beyond. Then he could find the girls and lead them back to safety. But first, he had to buy them some more time. Let them get further away from the camp. Kane fired behind him again, emptying his pistol. He tossed it aside. He slammed another magazine into the MP7 submachine gun and dropped to a kneeling position. He saw shadows moving in the jungle, backlit by the burning shack. He opened fire, sending a rain of death towards the men that pursued him. Then he turned and pushed his way through the reeds, towards the river. He saw its dark, glossy surface up ahead. In the moonlight, its rippling water looked like the scales of an enormous black serpent. Kane took a step forward and felt the cool water slosh against his leg. Suddenly, he felt something sharp pierce his neck. He reached back. His fingers brushed against a hard, sharp object, buried in his skin. He ripped it out and examined it in the moonlight. It was a dart, the kind that was launched from a high-powered air rifle. Kane had participated in many kidnappings, or extraordinary renditions, as they were known in the trade. He knew the dart would be laced with a potent sedative. He cursed. This was the weapon of a government operative, not jungle guerrillas or human traffickers. He had not prepared for this. He took another step forward and stumbled. The muscles in his legs went numb. He collapsed, falling face forward into the river. As his head sank into the dark water, a black mist engulfed his mind. He felt light as air, as if the faint current might sweep him away. Nyana is free, he thought. At least there was that. He heard splashing footsteps surrounding him. Strong hands lifted him from the water and dragged him to shore.
Da, this is the man I told you about.
The voice was deep and thick, and spoke with a Russian accent.
He is going by the name Mokwatas, but his real name is Thomas Kane.
Alexei Rudolph gazed down at Kane with his strange, blue eyes. Another man stood next to him, his face hidden by a dark shadow. Who are these men? Kane thought. How do they know my name? The other man tilted his head, examining Kane's face.
Bring him, the man said. I wish to talk to him.
As the effects of the drug increased, Kane's senses began to deaden. He heard the sound of the man's voice twist and distort into a deep growl.
What is there to talk about?
Alexei asked.
You wanted to see his face. Now you see. We kill him and be done with it.
Who overcomes by force hath overcome by half his foe.
What the hell are you talking about?
The man strode away.
I said bring him. Do not question me again, Alexei.
Then Kane heard nothing more. He sank into the black depths of unconsciousness. Chapter 16. A thin beam of light filled Kane's vision. He realized it was his own eyelids, cracking open. His thoughts felt thick and slow, as if his mind were trapped in quicksand. He felt the slight irritation at the back of his neck, and remembered the dart striking him there. He could hear the sounds of the jungle in the distance. Dirt pressed against his cheek. He was outside. The night air was humid and oppressive, and his clothes were soaked with sweat. He groaned and rolled over. His arms and legs were cuffed together with zip ties. As his vision cleared, his surroundings came into focus. He was lying on the ground, in the dirt pen, the one that had previously held Nyana and the other girls. Two men approached the cage. They wore frayed camouflage pants and old, worn t-shirts. One of the shirts was faded red, with a white eagle printed on the front. The other man's shirt featured a can of soda in a bright yellow circle. The design looked familiar, but all the writing was in Asian characters Kane could not read. The men murmured to each other in a sing-song patois of Chinese and Burmese. One kept an AK-47 trained on Kane, while the other opened the gate and stepped inside the pen. He flicked open a butterfly knife, slit the straps that bound Kane's legs, and hoisted him to his feet.
You follow, the man said in broken English. He want to see you now.
Kane held up his bound wrist and smiled, but the man ignored him and gave him a shove towards the gate. They walked Kane through the camp, past the shack he had set on fire. The building was now a pile of ash and blackened timbers that had collapsed into the creek. Kane saw little movement elsewhere in the camp. He had cut down their numbers in the gunfight, and he assumed the men that were left had dispersed into the jungle to search for the girls. He hoped he had given them enough of a head start. He was led to the largest building in the camp, which wasn't saying much. The large shack was still constructed of scavenged scraps and rotting timbers, but it was three times the size of the other buildings. A torn red curtain hung over the entrance. Kane heard classical music drifting out from between the strips of fabric. The men nudged him forward. Kane parted the curtain with his bound fists and ducked into the dark interior. Inside, the room was lit by several bulbous paper lanterns that hung from the ceiling. They cast a warm glow over a low, square table. Mildewed cushions were scattered across the floor. Alexei Rudolf sat cross-legged on one of the cushions. His large, blue eyes squinted in discomfort. A few feet away from him sat an older Asian man, one Kane had not seen before. He looked to be in his late 40s, although it was difficult to tell. His face looked drawn and tired, haggard even, but his skin was tan and soft, and had a youthful appearance. His shoulders and chest were slim and athletic. He wore his hair long, and it framed his narrow, hawkish features. The hair, like his eyes, was pure jet black. Only his goatee showed any signs of gray. He was eating from a bowl of rice and vegetables. He lifted the food into his mouth with slow, deliberate motions of his right hand. He kept his left hand under the table. Kane stood in silence for a moment. The music played softly in the background, but he did not recognize the piece. The man looked up and observed him with coal-black eyes. Reaching out as if in slow motion, the man pointed to the table. Sit. Eat. His voice was deep and powerful. Kane sat down cross-legged, opposite the man. He held up his fists. Do you mind? Hard to eat like this. The man smiled thinly and slowly chewed his food. I'm sure you will manage. Try the tea leaf salad. It's delightful. Kane sighed. He tried to remember when his last meal had been. Whatever was coming, it would be better to face it with a full stomach. He grabbed a small metal bowl and did his best to scoop some of the rice and vegetable concoction into it with his bound hands. The tea salad consisted of bitter green tea leaves, mixed with sliced tomatoes, cabbage, chickpeas, and nuts. The cold dish was refreshing, and mixed well with the warm, steamed rice. Kane tipped the bowl into his mouth, ignoring the bits of food that spilled to the ground. A young boy, just a teenager from the looks of his lanky body and oversized clothes, hurried into the room. The boy filled all their cups with water from a wooden jug. Then he bowed and rushed back out through the red curtains. Alexei Rudolf stared at Kane with his strange blue eyes. His mouth was curled into a sneer. Kane carefully lifted his water cup to his lips and took a long sip. He matched Alexei's gaze with his cold, green eyes, and the Russian looked away. He set the cup down. Why am I here? He asked. The other man looked up. Alexei here says he knows you. Says you used to be a spy. I don't know him, Alexei grunted, but I have seen his file. Back in my days with the FSB. He is a spy and a traitor. He's supposed to be dead. So that was how Rudolf had recognized him. Although the United States and Russia maintained an uneasy alliance, from time to time Kane had come up against operatives of the FSB, Russia's Federal Security Service. It was the modern successor to the old Cold War beast of the KGB. It made sense they would have a file of some sort on him. Is that true? The other man asked. Who are you? Kane asked in return. The man smiled. I am Kang Longwei, but you know of me by another name. Pizak, Kane said. The man nodded. That is a Thai word, but yes, Pizak, not so in Burmese. I am the devil. Now, please answer me. Is Alexei's story true? Kane turned to Alexei. How does the FSB feel about you, Alexei? Leaving military service to work for criminals? You don't rise up in the Russian mafia without doing hard time, and I don't see any prison ink on you. I assume your daddy did the time. Alexei slammed his fist down on the table. I kill you for these words you speak. Enough talk! Kang rested a hand on Alexei's arm. The Russian seemed to calm down, but his lazy eye twitched with rage. Kang knew he had struck a nerve. Kang placed more food in his mouth and chewed. He drank more water. "You'll come into my home," he said. "You steal my property? Kill my men. All for what? I want to understand why you do this. I want to take a measure of you as a man. Considering you kidnap girls and blow up innocent people, I don't really give a damn what you think of me," Kang replied. Kang nodded, his black eyes open wide. "You do not want to say, but I think you came for these girls. They are important to you. Or perhaps one of them is. I think I understand now." "You don't know a thing about me," Kang said. Kang laughed. "Oh, you are wrong, Mr. Kang. You and I are not so different. When I look in your face, I ask myself, why is a man like this, a white man, a man supposedly without honor, here in this jungle? Why is he risking his life for these girls? Alexei calls you a traitor, but when I look in your face, I see something else." "Yeah? What do you see?" "I see betrayal." Kang said nothing. Kang nodded. "My eyes see the truth. I know all about betrayal. Once you are wounded by true, deep betrayal, you are never the same. Am I right?"
"Why are we wasting time with this asshole?"
Alexei asked, his voice snarling with anger. "Our shipment leaves tomorrow. The girls are missing. We have to find them before—" "Please do not interrupt me," Kang said, pivoting his head to stare at Alexei. "These are city girls you are talking about. Bar girls. How far do you think they could possibly go in this jungle? My men will find them, and all will be as it was. In the meantime, I wish to enjoy my conversation with Mr. Kang."
Alexei stood up. "Forgive me," he muttered. "I seem to have lost my appetite. I go outside and smoke."
He stormed out of the room, tossing aside the red curtains as he exited the shack. Kang was alone with Kang. Alone with the devil, Pizak. "Maybe this is my chance." Kang shook his head and looked back at Kang. "Much anger in that one. Now, as I was saying, do you think you are the only one who has been betrayed? You were what? A soldier? An assassin? I was killing for my people by the time I was 16 years old." Kang pushed his plate of food away. He set a small metal dish on a rack above a candle. Reaching into the folds of his clothes, he removed a red tablet and set it down on the plate. Kang watched as the heat from the candle began to melt the tablet. Droplets of red liquid began to sizzle and burn on the plate. Yaba. Kang was familiar with the drug. Its effects included sudden bursts of energy, euphoria, and the feeling of invincibility. "I fought with the Burmese Communist Party when the military junta seized control of the government. It was still called Burma then," Kang continued, watching the pill disintegrate. "I say fought, but that's not entirely true. We fought some, yes. But for the most part, our task was murder. I was inserted behind enemy lines. My men and I targeted officers, political figures, schools and hospitals. Our job was to spread fear. You would call me a terrorist, Mr. Kang, but the Communist Party of Burma called me a revolutionary. They financed our war with opium money and Chinese weapons." Kang shook his head. "Communism, Chinese nationalists, civil wars. It all seems like some strange dream now. None of it makes any sense to me. I don't suppose it ever did. All I knew was that I was ordered to kill. So I did. I was good at it. I don't need a history lesson," Kang said. "If you're going to kill me, just get on with it. I most likely will, after I have tortured you." Kane's muscles tensed, but he maintained an aura of calm. "I have no information for you." "Oh, I'm sure we can think of some questions. Perhaps you sent these girls somewhere into the jungle? You have a vehicle hidden across the river? A rendezvous point?" Kang said nothing. Kang shrugged. "We shall see. Either way, there will be pain. Pain brings clarity. I feel you do not yet understand the true nature of where you are, of who you are."
"And you think you do?"
Kang nodded. "Yes. As I said,
I know betrayal well. In 1989, the Communist Party of Burma reformed into the United Wa State. A ceasefire was declared with the Myanmar government. Kang leaned over the small plate and inhaled the vapor of the burning pill deep into his lungs. He looked up, and his eyes glowed with an inner fire and intensity. Both sides had grown weary of bloodshed. Everyone wanted peace. Concessions were made. There were secret conditions to the ceasefire. Backroom deals we knew nothing about. One of these conditions was that my men and I be turned over to the military, to face justice. I'm sure you can imagine what that meant, Mr. Kane. Torture, Kane said. Yes. Years of pain in a dark, diseased military prison. The United Wa State Army gave Myanmar armed forces the location of our camp. It was a price they were willing to pay for peace. We were betrayed. Convicted as war criminals with no trial to speak of. Most of us were killed. After years of captivity, I was able to escape, but not without a cost. Kang lifted his left arm from under the table. His hand was chopped off at the wrist. A metal cap sealed off the wound. A claw-like hand was screwed into the end of the arm. Must make using chopsticks tricky, Kane said. I cut it off myself, Mr. Kane. It was the only way to free my arm from the chains that held me. I spilled much blood that day. I fought and killed and clawed my way to freedom. And, much like you, I imagine, I made my way here, hoping to disappear. Other refugees of my people had crossed the border into Thailand and formed the Red Wa. They resumed their drug trade with China. I joined with them. I began killing again. It was only natural. And soon, I worked my way up to become leader of this cell. Now I am free. I understand the true nature of this world, and my place in it. When you have suffered betrayal, when you have screamed in pain, knowing it will never end, when you have lost all hope, then it becomes clear. What becomes clear? Kang smiled. That we are all in hell, Mr. Kane. You, me, all of us. We are lost, trapped here in hell until we reach the next life. And once you realize that, it only takes a short time to reach the obvious conclusion. Enlighten me, Kane said. Kang sucked in more vapor. He coughed, and it took Kane a second or two to realize that, beneath his gasping for air, he was laughing. In hell, there are only two kinds of souls, the devils and the damned. The older man used his right hand to waft the smoke up into his mouth and nostrils. His eyes closed in blissful peace. He inhaled again. Now! The voice screamed in Kane's mind. He lurched forward over the table, and the fingers of his bound hand stretched wide, grasping for Kang's throat. Without opening his eyes, Kang shifted sideways. Kane had never seen anyone move so fast. He slammed down on the table, sending Kang's food and platter of drugs cascading to the ground. Kang raised his right arm into the air. Kang tried to roll off the table to avoid the blow, but again the man was too fast for him. The arm struck like lightning. Kang saw the flash of steel in the dim light. The knife struck the table like a crack of thunder. The blade pierced the collar of Kang's shirt, pinning him to the table like an insect in a museum display. Kang looked down on him and laughed. His pupils seemed to swallow the whites of his eyes. Kang heard a pair of footsteps enter the room behind him. He shifted his eyes and saw the two guards from earlier had come, as if somehow summoned by Kang. The older man stopped laughing and gestured to the curtain. Show him the iron road. The man grabbed him under the arms and lifted him to his feet, tearing his shirt free of the knife. You will see, Kang said, his voice low and calm. It only takes a short time, not much time at all, to decide. Devil or damned, Mr. Kane. Devil or damned. The men dragged him out of the room. Chapter 17. Kane bit down on his lip so hard he tasted blood. The pain. It had started as a slight irritation, but had grown in intensity. He knew it would keep increasing, building until he would no longer be able to stop himself. He would scream. But for now, he refused to give his tormentors the satisfaction.
His heart raced. Beads of sweat dripped from his body, and his tattered clothes were already soaked. His pants were sliced at the knees, exposing his legs. His hands and feet were tied to a wooden table that stood under a thatched roof. Above him, the two guards grinned as they watched his body writhe in pain. In his head, he had named them Eagle and Soda Can, after the designs on their shirts. The iron road consisted of a long, heavy metal rod that was studded with tiny spikes. The rod was rolled up and down the flesh of the man's shins. The weight of the rod itself provided all the pressure needed. The men merely rolled the heavy length of rod up and down. The motion was almost gentle. Soon, the spikes began to prick the skin. Dots of blood appeared. With each turn of the rod, the blood increased. The wounds grew deeper. Soon, Kane's legs were covered with blood. He knew the rod would eventually strip the flesh from his shins, until nothing was left but bone and blood.
"Where you send the girls?"
Eagle asked.
"Tell us, and we stop."
They asked their questions in flat, monotone voices. They didn't care about the answers. They didn't want to stop. Kane glared at them, then spit on the ground. He had been tortured before. Those long, dark days of pain and misery had left a mark on his soul. Kang was right. After that betrayal, after that pain, Kane knew he had never been the same. The experience had scarred him. And now, as the pain built in intensity, he felt his mind regressing, as if he were being transported back in time. It was as if the pain was all pain. There was no difference. One second he was here, trapped in this jungle hell, the iron rod slowly tearing through the flesh of his legs. The next, he was hanging in a dark stone room, his body twitching and swaying as savage jolts of electricity ripped through his muscles. The past, the present, all was a blur, a miasma of despair and hopelessness, linked only by pain and terror. Devils. His soul was tormented by devils. His heartbeat was all he could hear. It drowned out the noise of the jungle, the laughing of the men. It flooded his ears with its rapid pounding. Faster and faster it beat, until he was certain it would explode from his chest. His mind screamed at him, cutting through the roar of blood pumping through his veins. "Get a grip. Keep control. Control is all you have. If you scream, they win." The rod tore at his flesh. Kane did not scream. Suddenly, another sound cut through the red cloud of pain and fear that surrounded his senses. A soft crack, a rapid puff of air. It was a sound he had heard before, he realized, at the river, before he lost consciousness. It was the sound of an air rifle. The man he knew as Soda Can jerked an arm up to his neck. "What the hell?" he uttered. Eagle stopped rolling the iron rod. "What's wrong?" Soda Can slumped to the ground. Eagle immediately backed up and raised his AK-47. He scanned the darkness. "Who dare? Come out or I shoot!" There was another soft crack. Eagle staggered back. He pulled the trigger of his assault rifle, but nothing happened. Click, click. Eagle fumbled with the weapon, and Kane realized he must have left the safety on. As the drug ran through his nervous system, the man struggled to throw the safety lever to the fire position. He fell to the ground, unconscious. Kane turned his head and saw a figure emerge from the darkness. It was Nyana. Her skin was streaked with dirt and mud, and her hair was tangled with leaves and bits of vine. A light sheen of sweat made her coffee-colored skin glisten in the flickering torchlight. Alexei's tranquilizer rifle hung by her side. She rushed over to him. "Nyana, what are you doing here?" Kane hissed. "I told you to go."
"I did go. The other girls, they ran. I start to run too, but I feel ashamed. You came for me. You saved me. Now I save you."
She patted down the unconscious body of Soda Can and removed a large survival knife from a sheath at his waist. The knife was sharp, and it took only a few strokes to slice through the bonds that held Kane's wrists. Kane sat up and took the knife from her. Scanning the jungle for movement, he severed the ropes that held his feet. He examined his injuries. His legs were bloody, but despite the pain, the wounds were not severe. "I appreciate it, Nyana. I do, but it's dangerous here. You could have been caught again." The girl shook her head.
The camp looks deserted. I find this rifle in jeep outside the shack where the Russian sleeps, but he not there.
Kang sent most of his men into the jungle, looking for you, Kane whispered.
Yes, I hear them. They make noise like wild pigs, stomping around. My family come from mountains like these. When I was little girl, my father teach me how to hunt, how to be quiet, so animals don't hear me.
And how to shoot, apparently, Kane said. Quick, help me hide the bodies. They dragged the two men into the underbrush of the jungle. Kane winced from the pain in his legs, but he forced himself to ignore it. He felt the weight of the knife in his hand. The men were laid out in front of him, unconscious. It would be a simple matter to slice their throats. He didn't know when they might wake up. It was a logical precaution. His blood still boiled with rage. The pain and fear of the torture they had just subjected him to still clouded his mind. He looked up and saw Nyana staring at him, a curious expression on her face.
What are you doing?
She asked. Her brown eyes looked soft and concerned. Kane felt his rage subside. Nothing. He grabbed one of the men's AK-47s and slung it around his shoulder. Let's go. They made their way through the dark jungle back towards the river. True to her word, Nyana moved silently through the dense foliage. Kang underestimated her, Kane thought. She could have easily avoided his patrols and fled, but instead she had come back for him. She had risked her life to save him. He had seen trained soldiers panic and abandon their comrades under similar circumstances. Suddenly, Kane detected a familiar smell. He held up his hand and stopped moving. Nyana froze.
What is it?
She whispered. Wait here, Kane whispered back. He crept forward into the darkness, following the scent. It was smoke from a cigarette. With soft, slow steps, Kane tracked the scent. Using the barrel of the AK-47, he brushed aside a branch of thick green leaves. Up ahead, in a small clearing, he saw the dark form of Alexei Rudov, pacing back and forth in the moonlight. A lit cigarette hung from his lips. Bad habit, Kane thought. One that could kill you. Kane stepped into the clearing. Don't move, Alexei. The Russian spun around to face him. Who is there? Kane took another step forward, allowing a shaft of moonlight to illuminate his face. Alexei shook his head. Kane, I told him to kill you. Alexei walked towards Kane, his hands held up in a position of surrender. Kane knew the maneuver well. The Russian was trying to close the distance between them, to improve his odds. Don't come any closer, Alexei. Your next step will be your last. Alexei froze in place. Where's Kang? Kane asked. The Russian exhaled a puff of smoke. I have no idea. He wanders the jungle at night. Nobody knows where he goes. The man is insane, yes? You should choose better business partners, then. Da, this deal of ours, it was a mistake to get involved with this man. The bombings, the dead cop, you. Trust me, if I could do it over again, I would tell him to fuck off. Dead cop? Kane asked. You mean Satra. What about him? Alexei's eyes narrowed. His lips curled in a smile. He is here. His body is here, in the camp. Kang has another bomb as well. I can show you. We make deal, yes?
Kane thought for a moment. He knew he should kill this man and get Nyana out of the camp as soon as possible. But Satra, if he had only listened to Satra and helped him, maybe none of this would have happened. And he remembered the photograph Satra had shown him, the bodies in the market. If Kang was planning on setting off another bomb, on killing more innocents as a show of force, he knew Satra would have done anything to stop it. Kane made his decision. Show me this bomb, and I'll consider it.
Da, good. It is back at camp. This way.
One more thing, Kane said, not moving from his position. If you betray me, if you make a single move I don't like, I won't hesitate to kill you. No matter what happens to me, you die first. Understand? Alexei examined Kane with his lazy blue eye. He sighed and nodded.
I understand. I have read your file. I know who you are. I know the things you have done. I have no wish to test you.
Kane smiled. Good. He waved to Nyana. The girl moved from her place of concealment and entered the clearing. She stared at Alexei with disgust.
You, this pig is the one who took me.
I know, Kane said, but there's more at stake here than just us. We have to follow this man for just a little while longer. There's something we have to do in camp. Then we can leave. Nyana eyed the Russian, then nodded.
I trust you. Whatever you say.
Kane gestured with the rifle.
All right, Alexei. Show us this bomb.
Chapter 18. Alexei Rudov led Kane and Nyana through the jungle, back towards the camp. As Nyana had observed, the ground seemed to be deserted. The campfire had burned out and was now just a smoldering pile of ash and glowing embers. Kane kept Alexei a safe distance ahead of them. He saw no signs of movement in the camp. No sign of Kang. They stopped near another large shack. The sound of a gas power generator puttering in the distance, near the building. Alexei pointed through the jungle.
There. That is where they are keeping the bomb. And your friend's body. Because you are here, Kang believes the royal police have reopened the investigation into the missing girls. He says they will need another demonstration. Another bomb. And another letter.
Satra's blood, Kane said. That's why he kept the body.
Da, it is as you say. I keep my end of bargain, Kane. Now you keep yours. Let me go.
I said I'd consider it, Alexei. I'm still considering. Nyana? Nyana smiled as she aimed the rifle at Alexei.
Wait. You can't leave me in this jungle. You can't. Nyana fired.
The dart struck Alexei in the chest. Just above his heart. His face filled with rage.
You lying bastard! I kill you! Then I strangle this stupid whore!
He took a step towards them, fist poised to strike. Kane raised his rifle, but before he could fire, Alexei fell face first onto the ground. Nyana stood over him and spat on his back.
Russian pig!
She kicked Alexei's unmoving body.
Keep it down, Kane hissed. We still don't know where Kang is.
I'm sorry. You're right. What do we do now?
There's something I have to do for a friend. He tried to help you, tried to help the other girls too, but Kang had him killed.
I'm sorry for your friend.
Me too. Now, I want you to get across the river. Stay out of sight. I'll come find you when I'm finished here. Then we'll look for the other girls.
No, I go with you.
Nyana, please. I came all this way to make sure you were safe. This is something I have to do alone. Just wait for me. I promise I won't be long. He handed her the AK-47. Here, take this. Go quickly. Nyana stared at Kane, her eyes wide with concern and fear. Then she slung the automatic weapon over her shoulder.
All right, I go. Please hurry.
Kane nodded. Believe me, I will. The girl turned and disappeared into the jungle. Kane stalked towards the shack, the wounds in his legs throbbing in agony. Kane pushed forward. The interior of the shack was dark. Kane paused at the entrance. A rotting stench wafted out from the darkness. He could just make out a set of work lights, perched on a small metal stand near the doorframe. He crept over to the lights and felt around for a switch. Then he flicked it. The lights flared, and he blinked while his eyes adjusted to the sudden illumination. He adjusted the lights, dialed them back to a dim glow, just enough to see by. The camp still appeared to be abandoned, but he didn't want to push his luck. He scanned the interior of the cabin. A workbench was set up in the far corner of the room. On top of the bench was a new-looking canvas duffel bag and a variety of electronics tools. A large burlap sack hung from a hook in the ceiling. It swayed gently in the night air. It was about the size of a man. It stank of dead flesh. Kane made his way to the sack and reached up. Using the knife he had taken from Nyana, he sliced a foot-long incision in the top of the bag. Satra's head rolled out. A dark gash was cut across his throat. Kane took a step back. Again, he felt pangs of guilt gnawing at his gut. If I had said yes sooner, if I had helped him... He shook his head and cleared his mind. There was still work to be done. Satra's flesh was pale and gray. Cain ripped open the bag further, revealing that the corpse had been stripped from the waist up. Knife wounds crisscrossed the body's chest and arms. Cain examined the throat wound. The edges were swollen, and thick clots of blood lined either side of the gash. The wounds in the chest were different. Those cuts were not inflamed, and there was little excess blood. They were post-mortem, Cain decided. Kang's men had killed Satra by slitting his throat, then removed the body before setting off the bomb in his apartment. Satra had told him that the last public bombing was accompanied by a warning note to the police, written in a missing policeman's blood. If Alexei was right, if a new bomb was going to be set off in a public place, then this time it would be Satra's blood on the note. Kang clenched his fist. No, he thought. There will be no bomb. No note. Not this time. Cain walked over to the workbench. He took a deep breath and unzipped the duffel bag. Inside, he found exactly what he expected. Two large, plastic jugs were packed with a whitish-yellow powder. A small electronics package was taped to the bottles, and wires ran from the center into the powder. It was a bomb. Cain recognized another of Eddie Ashikaga's military-grade detonators in the center of the wires and circuits. The plastic jugs held compressed TNT. Based on the amount present, Cain judged the bomb was powerful enough to wipe out a city block. Or, he thought, the entire Redwaw camp. The detonator was attached to a cell phone. The device could be set to detonate upon receipt of the call. The call could also trigger an alarm timer in the other phone, giving more time for the bomber to make his escape. Cain was familiar with such devices. He had used them many times himself. Cain examined the phone. The model wired up to the detonator used a push-to-talk system. Essentially, the phone was capable of acting as a short-range walkie-talkie, perfect for areas with poor cell phone reception. Cain searched the workbench and found another identical phone, sitting in a charging cradle behind the duffel bag. He turned on the phone and checked the battery. It was charged and active. There was only one number programmed into the phone's memory. Cain reached into the duffel bag and pressed a button on the detonator. A small screen blinked to life, showing some menus and options. Cain quickly navigated to the settings he was looking for. He determined that the device's timer was set to 5 minutes. Cain pressed another series of buttons. A red LED light began to blink on the device. It was now armed. As he zipped up the bag, he heard the wood floor creak behind him. He felt the old, familiar tingle on his neck, that sixth sense of danger, honed by years of instinct. Cain twisted his body to the right and felt the red-hot sting of a blade cutting across the skin of his shoulder. His sudden movement had turned what would have been a fatal stab into a painful slash instead. Still unable to see his adversary, he threw his left elbow back and felt it connect with the man's face. His attacker grunted and stumbled back as Cain whirled around. He slipped the cell phone into his pocket and held up the survival knife in a defensive pose. He found himself facing Kang Long Wei. The dim light cast shadows over the hollows of Kang's gaunt features. Staring out from the grim, demonic face were two eyes, two burning black dots. They looked like tiny eclipsed suns, blazing with drug-induced fury. Kang. Pizak. The devil. In place of the metal claw he had used at dinner, a foot-long blade was now screwed into the metal cap at the end of his arm. The weapon's cutting edge was serrated with a series of savage-looking barbs. "Nice knife," Cain said. "I see you have made your choice, Mr. Cain." His voice a deep and guttural rasp. "Welcome to hell. Let's see just what kind of devil you are." Chapter 19. Cain charged towards Kang and swung out with his knife in a tight slash. Rather than block the feint, Kang stepped backwards, moving out of range. As the blow swung past him, he hopped forward again, thrusting with the blade that was affixed to the end of his arm. Cain pivoted and pushed Kang's knife arm away, causing the thrust to go wide. At the same time, he transferred his blade to his other hand and stabbed upwards, aiming for the exposed pit of Kang's arm. Kang swung his right arm down into a block before the blade touched his flesh. He slashed inwards with his knife, forcing Cain to break and step away. The two men sized each other up and began stepping left and right, each angling for an opening. After a series of feints and blocks, neither man claimed the advantage. They continued bobbing and weaving across the floor of the shack. The two men's fighting styles were completely different. Kane kept his attacks and blocks in a tight box pattern, roughly the width of his shoulders and from his neck to his groin. His thrusts and slash were quick, efficient movements. They used a minimum of energy and did not leave him exposed to an easy counterattack. But Kang spun and whirled his blade through the air with a fluid, dancing motion. He fought as though his weapon were a natural extension of his limb. The sweeping, erratic movements were difficult to predict. They seemed to leave him wide open, a weakness that should have been easy to exploit. But time after time, Kang found his attacks blocked, or Kang spun out of the way before his blade could strike. Kane wasn't sure if it was due to Kang's drug-fueled euphoria, or if it simply came down to a higher level of skill, but the truth was undeniable. Kang was faster than he was, and Kane knew that a knife fight in a tight, closed environment like the shack would give him no opportunity to rest. Sooner or later, Kane would grow tired. Kane saw an opening and stabbed inwards, thrusting the tip of his blade sideways towards the right side of Kang's neck. But the older man's right arm swung up into the air like a cobra, raising to strike. His palm slapped Kane's wrist away, and his body swung sideways, leaving his left arm facing Kane. He swung out, and the blade sliced across Kane's midsection. Kang's right hand hooked around in a punch, and Kane felt his neck snap back as the blow connected. He stumbled backwards, struggling to put some distance between himself and Kang's blade. Kang smiled serenely.
"Perhaps I was wrong about you, Mr. Kane. You have allowed yourself to hide amongst the damned for too long. You have lost your power. But here in hell, only the powerful survive."
Kane slashed forward again, but Kang blocked the blow with little effort and thrust with his knife. Kane dodged, but Kang diverted the thrust in midair. He slashed upwards, cutting across the flesh of Kane's knife arm. The bloody wound joined those on his abdomen and legs. Kane panted for breath.
"You are getting tired. Slow."
Kang punctuated his words with another thrust. Kane stepped forward and blocked the blow, but before he could counterstrike, Kang's fingers lanced forward, striking into his throat. Kang gasped for air. His knife fell from his grasp, clattering to the floor. He raised his hand to protect his bruised throat from another blow.
"It is time,"
Kang said, his lips curled into a smile.
"Time for you to leave this hell. The next one awaits you."
Kane shuffled backwards, trying to increase the space between them. He needed to buy some time, catch his breath, but suddenly, he felt a heavy weight brush up against his back. His retreat was blocked by Satra's hanging corpse. He heard the rope creak as the burlap sack pulled and spun on a hook in the ceiling.
"Maybe so, Kang,"
Kane said. The words hissed from his swollen, injured throat.
"But I promise you, I won't be alone."
Kang snarled and thrust forward with all his strength. Kane pushed backwards, using the motion to spin his body around the hanging carcass. As he fell back, Kang's long knife drove forward, just missing Kane. It slashed through the burlap sack and plunged deep into Satra's corpse. The blade sunk up to its hilt. Kang found himself staring into the gray, lifeless face of the dead policeman. Satra's eyes were unblinking, unseeing. His lifeless head dropped forward from the force of the impact. Kang cursed in Chinese and yanked his arm back to withdraw the blade. The blade would not budge. He pulled harder, and Satra's body swung towards him. The blade was still embedded deep in the corpse's flesh, refusing to come free. Kang stumbled to his feet. He watched Kang struggle to free his blade and realized what must have happened. He had seen it happen in knife fights before. The serrated barbs on Kang's knife had caught on the ribs of the corpse. The knife was stuck, and Kang would not be able to pull it free without cutting down the body. Kang stepped forward, adrenaline crackling through his body. This was his chance. His fist lashed out in a kidney punch. Kang gasped as the blow struck its target. The man collapsed to the ground, his arm still trapped in the flesh of the swaying corpse. "This isn't hell, Kang," Kang gasped. "But I'll see you there someday."
Cain charged forward and ran out of the door of the shack. He raced through the camp, running as fast as he could towards the river. As he ran, he pulled the cell phone out of his pocket. He had already pressed the send button and triggered the detonator just after Kang's attack. He had meant what he had said to Kang. He would not go to hell alone. The screen of the phone showed a small countdown clock. There were 10 seconds left. 10 seconds to make it to safety. Searing pain shot through his legs as he ran through the jungle camp. Leaves and branches smacked at his face. The air he sucked into his lungs felt like molten lead being poured over his raw, damaged throat. Up ahead, he saw the black surface of the river. He pushed himself harder. Faster, damn it! He screamed at himself. Run faster! He felt the cold water strike his legs, and the pain from his wounds flared white hot. He dove forward into the river's dark embrace. Behind him, the world erupted in thunder and fire. The shockwave was deafening. Even underwater, he felt as if a giant had slammed his fist into both his ears. He tumbled beneath the surface, sinking deeper into the currents. Above him, the rippling black water lit up bright orange. Even with his eyes closed, he could see the glow of the explosion. The hot jungle air ignited into a massive cloud of fire. And then it was over. The glow receded into the darkness, and the thunder echoed into a distant murmur. Then, the only sound was the rush of water around him and the tiny bits of debris that pelted the river's surface. Kane rose up from the murky depths and gasped for air. His legs buckled as he stepped onto the opposite riverbank. He paused for breath. He felt exhausted, as though even just one more step was beyond the feeble reserves of energy he had left. Then he saw Nyana, and she rushed down the hill towards him. He forced himself to trudge forward, one step after another, until at last he was standing on dry land. Nyana embraced him. As he felt her warm arms wrap around his body, he collapsed.
"Oh my God, you're hurt,"
she said. She ran her hand over his abdomen, leaving streaks of warm blood across his flesh. "I'm fine," he gasped. "I just need a minute." He sank to the ground. Nyana cradled his head in her lap as he rested. He was at peace. It was just past dawn when the soldiers from Kang's camp returned, leading the other girls at gunpoint. There were 6 men, armed with a collection of pistols, machetes, and 1 AK-47. The girls looked exhausted, and their bodies streaked with dirt and mud from their flight through the jungle. As the group neared the riverbank, the men began to chatter amongst themselves in their strange mix of Chinese and Burmese. The rising sun cast its light on the remains of the camp. Blackened trees and smoldering timber were all that remained. A few plumes of smoke floated up into the purple and orange sky. The girls stared at the destruction with numb, half-opened eyes. As the men debated what to do, Kane stepped out from behind a grove of trees. He wielded an AK-47, and he took aim on the men in the rear of the group. He pulled the trigger, firing a short burst of gunfire. Red holes exploded across his target's back, and the men fell. The other men spun around and found themselves facing down the barrel of Kane's rifle. The girls screamed and dropped to the ground. "Kang is dead. Your camp is gone," Kane shouted. "Drop your weapons. Leave now, and you live." The men muttered to each other in quiet, nervous tones. Then they lowered their weapons to the ground and retreated, dispersing into the jungle. A few minutes later, they were out of sight. The only sign they had ever been there were the small pile of weapons and the single corpse that lay on the ground. Nyana stepped out from behind the trees. She ran over to the group, and they embraced, chatting to each other in rapid-fire Thai. Kang couldn't understand what they were saying, but after the ordeal he had been through, he was glad the girl seemed to be in good spirits. Something nagged at the back of his mind. He thought about the operation, the Red Wa, the Russian Mafia connection, Alexei Rudov. He realized there was still one last task to complete, to ensure the girl's safety, as well as his own. He took a deep breath and walked back to the river. When Nyana saw him heading towards the smoking ruins of the camp, she put a hand on his shoulder.
"Where you go? We get out of here now, yes?"
Kane picked up a pistol from the ground and handed it to her. "There's just one more thing I have to do. I promise, it won't take long. I doubt those men will come back. But just in case, take this. Keep an eye out."
Nyana looked uncertain, but she nodded. Kane stepped into the water.
Hey, wait!
She called after him. He glanced back at her. Her eyes were warm and alive, and her smile felt like sunshine on his face.
The other girls, they want to say thank you.
Kane nodded. Tell them they should thank Satra. He was the man in the shack. The one who died. Tell them he's the one who saved them.
He good man. You good man too,
she said in a quiet voice. Kane was quiet for a moment. I'll be right back, he said. Then, once again, he strode into the water and crossed over into the blackened, dead camp. Chapter 20. A couple weeks later, Kane made his way across the outdoor patio of the Glasshouse restaurant. The rainy season seemed to be a distant memory, and the sun blazed overhead in the azure sky. Its warm beams were refracted into 1,000 pinpoints of light by the glass gazebo in the center of the grounds. Kane spotted the table he was looking for, and walked over. Anna was seated beneath an enormous white umbrella. Next to her, sitting in its own white chair, was her doll. Her Luke Tep, Kane corrected himself. Tia. A platter of food was set down in front of the doll. Kane estimated that the cost of the food on the doll's plate could feed the average Thai family for a week. He sat down opposite Anna. He was dressed in khaki shorts and a white linen shirt, with the sleeves rolled up to the elbows. The wrinkled, leathery old woman cast a disapproving eye over his battered and bruised arms and legs.
You look like shit. Took a beating, I see.
I gave as good as I got. Anna nodded.
So I hear. No more Pizak? No more Thai Angel's website. And no more Alexei Rudolph, apparently.
Kane stared back at her and said nothing. Anna took a sip of water from a crystal glass and leaned back in her chair.
Well, I hope it was worth it. How is your pretty ball girl? She make all your fantasies come true?
Kane looked out over the water. The rolling waves reflected the sun's brilliance like a sea of liquid gold. He turned back to Anna. She's gone now. Moved back to her village, to be with her family. Anna peered at him from under the shadow of her umbrella.
Why don't you go visit her?
Kane shook his head. No, I think she's better off now. It's for the best. I appreciated her friendship, but my situation is complicated. She's safer this way. Anna nodded.
Too bad. But, as you say, maybe for the best. Well, all that remains is my payment. You owe me a favor. Would you like a drink?
No, thank you. I won't be staying. Anna looked over Kane's shoulder.
Here he comes now. He's not much, but he's loyal to me. More loyal than my own children. I think, with the right partner, he could go far.
Kane followed her gaze and saw Lau shuffling towards them across the patio. The pudgy man was dressed in a loud Hawaiian shirt and designer sunglasses. What's he doing here? Kane asked.
That's my favor,
Anna said.
Your smuggling operation is small time, but you have skills, relationships, and you've already paid off the police. Lau here has connections to suppliers, factories in Indonesia, Vietnam, Thailand. Working together, you two can increase your profits considerably. The Chow Fa will take a percentage, of course.
Lau sat down next to Kane, beaming. I work alone, Kane snapped. Anna stared at him with cold, dark eyes.
Not anymore. You will work with Lau, or you won't work at all. That is my price.
Kane leaned back in his chair. He knew the old woman could make his life difficult if she chose to. And, after recent events, the last thing he needed was another enemy. He sighed. Fine. But I smuggle liquor, cigarettes, counterfeit jeans, fake purses. He leaned forward and stared at Anna. He did not blink. No drugs. No guns. No people. Anna laughed.
We start small then. Keep you on the side of the angels for a little while longer, Mr. Walters.
Kane stood up. I don't believe in angels, or devils. I'm neither of those. Do you have a word for that?
Oh, yes, of course. I call them Thai Hong Mei Che Ka.
Yeah? What does that mean? Anna stroked the hair of her Luke Tep doll.
It is a spirit, a person who is dead, but does not realize it.
She looked up at him.
A lost soul.
Cain nodded. Well, I don't believe in ghosts either. He turned to leave. Lau stood and grabbed his shoulder.
Hey, wait. I contact you tomorrow about shipment. Good stuff. We make lots of money. But one problem. The Russian you kill, Alexei? What if Russian mafia trace back to us?
Cain stared at his new partner. Lau's tiny, pig-like eyes were covered by the mirrored blank stare of his sunglasses. The man's face was hungry, eager, and his lips were curled up in a nervous smile. Don't worry about it, Cain said. I took care of things. He slipped Lau's hand off his shoulder and walked away. Cain had worked with men like Lau before, men whose hunger for money, or power, or whatever vice they craved, consumed them. It was a slippery slope. The more you worked with people like that, the more they rubbed off on you. They could infect you, like a parasite that consumed from within. Cain wondered if he, too, would descend down that treacherous slope. How long would it be? How far would he have to fall? Until one day he would wake up and not recognize his own reflection. As he left Anna and Lau behind, Kang's words echoed in his mind.
It only takes a short time. Not much time at all.
The limousine cruised to a stop and idled in front of the dark warehouse. The night sky was still and cloudless. The moon bathed the metal walls and chain-link fence that surrounded them in cold, harsh light. Smoke rose from the limo's exhaust as the engine rumbled in the cold air. The windows of the vehicle were fogged, and the front wiper swept back and forth, clearing away the ice crystals that formed on the windshield. The rear door opened, and a tall, powerfully built man stepped out. His expensive suit and heavy cashmere overcoat shielded him from the harsh temperature. The coldest month in St. Petersburg, Russia, might be February, the man thought, but a November night was no picnic either. His hair was steel gray and cut military short, his eyes large and piercing blue. His name was Sergei Rudov. He ran one of the largest crime families of the Russian mafia. He was Vor, a thief in law. He had done time, earned the respect of his elders, and consolidated his power as he rose through the ranks of the darkest, most hellish prisons Mother Russia could lock him away in. Every step of the ladder, every man he killed, every crime he committed, was etched in the black ink across his skin. A vast tapestry of prison tattoos hid beneath his tailored suit. The ornate designs covered every inch of his flesh save for the hard, thick lines of his face. As he walked towards the warehouse, the door slid open. The screeching sound of metal scraping against metal echoed into the still night. A slim man in a black suit rushed out to meet him.
Mr. Rudolph, please, accept my condolences. I am so sorry to be the one who...
Show me, Antonovich. Now. His breath was an icy cloud of mist in the cold Russian night.
Da, of course, sir. This way.
The lanky man, Ivan Antonovich, led Sergei to a shipping container that lay in the center of the empty warehouse. Several armed men stood guard around the container. The men shifted on their feet and shrank back into the dark corners of the warehouse as Sergei and Ivan marched past them. The shipment was intercepted by our people at the Baltic shipyard. As always, sir, we brought it here and opened it. We had vans outside to transport the merchandise. The girls? To their respective buyers? But instead, Ivan's voice trailed off. The metal door of the container was open. Sergei stood at the edge for a moment, then stepped inside its long, narrow confines. A single body lay on the cold floor. A piece of paper was attached to its chest by a knife, stabbed deep into the corpse's flesh. The body was burned and its clothes were torn and shredded, but Sergei was able to identify who it was. It was the body of Alexei Rudov, the body of his son. Sergei ripped the dagger from the mangled corpse and held up the note. It appeared to be written in blood. The writing was Russian. He read it aloud, and his voice echoed through the container. Death to all those who betray Pizak, the devil of the Red Wall. Ivan slowly approached behind him.
Sir, it is Alexei, yes? The Red Wall has killed him?
Put out the word, Antonovich, Sergei's voice rumbled. Any member of our organization working with the Red Wall will face death by my hand.
He crumpled the note in his hands. As of now, we are at war. This has been Devil's Due, the Thomas Kane series, Book Zero, written by Andrew Warren, narrated by Brian L. Anderson. Copyright 2016 by Andrew Warren. Production copyright 2016 by Andrew Warren. For more information about Andrew Warren and the Thomas Kane series, please visit andrewwarrenbooks.com.